You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Greta Szarö, who is the organizing director with World Beyond War, where I am the director. So we are colleagues, but some of my colleagues are the most interesting people to bring on this program. Greta Szarö graduated as valedictorian from St. Michael's College in Vermont with a bachelor's degree in sociology, anthropology. She then pursued a master's in food studies at New York University before accepting a full-time community organizing job with Food and Water Watch, where she worked on issues related to fracking, genetically engineered foods, climate change, and corporate control of common resources. Greta Szarö describes herself as a vegetarian sociologist environmentalist. She and her partner currently live in an off-grid tiny home on their organic fruit and vegetable farm in upstate New York. Greta Szarö, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
So I just realized you're actually studying us. You're a sociologist infiltrating the peace movement to write a report about it. Is that what you're up to?
Well, I've always been interested in the connections between society and the environment, and that's really what got me started with sociology and then later studying food studies. And that's actually how this issue of war and militarism appealed to me, and why I got started with World Beyond War is because really when you look at it, war is at the nexus of these social and ecological ills facing us as a species and as a planet, due to the grave environmental impacts of war and its impacts on civil liberties, human rights, and the way that it drains trillions of dollars from our society.
Well, I couldn't agree more, but I suspect not everybody is quite onto that understanding. Does everybody in Food and Water Watch see militarism that way?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up. In my experience as a grassroots organizer with the environmental movement, I really didn't see these interconnections being made between militarism and the environment, or between other issues, as a matter of fact. And I think that in activism, there can be a tendency to stay in what I call our silos and just focus on these issues individually without really looking at the holistic picture of how they are interconnected. And as I said, how really war is impeding progress on any of these issues, as it's both draining our society of needed dollars, but also causing erosion to the environment and to society.
Do you think that keeping issues in their silos is the result just of lack of time and overwork and habit, I've always thought that one of the reasons that environmental groups didn't tend to go after one of the biggest destroyers of the environment in the Pentagon, and civil liberties groups wouldn't go after the militarism that created all the atrocities and on through all the different categories of activism, was that there's a perceived downside to going against militarism and patriotism and war songs and the troops, that it's not good for fundraising and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. If we look behind the curtains of how these groups are being funded, you're right. I think that some of the funders would not want to touch the issue of war and militarism. And I think the first thing that you said as well is correct, in the sense that people feel overwhelmed and they just feel that they can only tackle one issue at a time. But by getting stuck that way in our minds, we're really impeding progress as a unified mass movement, because all of these issues are connected at the core. And a lot of it does come down to economic injustice as the hinge tying it together.
How does that tie everything together?
Well, the fact that, as we said, war and militarism is draining all of these issues by spending in the United States, the U.S. government spends $1 trillion annually on war. So it's draining our society of dollars, and it's also perpetuating economic inequality by further concentrating money in the hands of a few politicians and top corporations that manufacture these weapons.
I'm glad you said that, because it's hardly mentioned in U.S. elections this week. So how did you see the connections, and how did you choose to get involved in working with World Beyond War and in the peace movement?
Well, I guess because of my background in sociology, I've always been looking holistically at these issues, and as I said, at the interconnections between society and the environment. So it wasn't a far stretch for me to put these pieces together when looking at the war machine. And so that's really why World Beyond War's work appealed to me. If you go to our website, worldbeyondwar.org, you'll see that we really make the case for how war is having these multifaceted impacts on our species and planet. And I think that we do a very good job of laying out those holistic impacts.
And how as a young person have you gotten involved in this? And I ask because when I go around and speak to peace groups, to self-selected audiences of people interested in opposing war, they are very disproportionately white and middle class and urban and various other things, but in particular, old. I'm young at a peace event, and I'm probably at least twice or close to twice your age. How can young people get involved in caring about war and peace?
Well, I think that we do see millennials and young people very highly involved in certain movements, such as Occupy Wall Street, which was bringing awareness to economic injustice, the 99% versus the 1%, the top corporations who are making all the money and further concentrating money. And also we saw with the Bernie Sanders movement a couple of years ago that that was really driven by millennials, and he as well was addressing this issue of the 99% versus the 1% in economic injustice. So when we're talking about engaging young people, I think we have to stick to that core message of economic injustice and show how, as we've discussed, war and militarism is further perpetuating that.
I think that's a good angle. So how is organizing going? Where is World Beyond War getting people organized and active, and what's working and what's not?
Well, World Beyond War is a global grassroots network of volunteers, chapters, and affiliated organizations advocating for the abolition of the entire institution of war and its replacement with what we call an alternative global security system, one that is based on peace and demilitarization. And so our work is fundamentally anchored in that peace education of raising awareness about these issues that we've been discussing. And we have our book, which we publish every year, that lays out the strategies for managing conflicts nonviolently, demilitarizing, and establishing a culture of peace. And then on top of our book, we've built out a whole series of other educational materials that our volunteers use to hold events, film screenings, guest lectures, PowerPoint presentations, and other events in their community to engage people, educate, and then mobilize for change.
And we've had some big conferences, including one since you've been on board, right?
Yes, every year we hold an annual conference on the International Day of Peace, September 21st. And the past conference that we did in Toronto 2 months ago was looking at how do we change systems of global governance? How do we establish legal frameworks that move us towards a world beyond war?
And one of the campaigns that you've been especially involved in, Greta, is divestment, which I myself sometimes have a hard time understanding. Can you try to explain to people what divestment from war means?
Yes. So divestment is divesting, withdrawing money, monetary funds, from companies that invest in weapons manufacturers and military contractors. So, for example, you as an individual might have your retirement funds or your savings invested in a bank or a mutual fund institution that then reinvests that money in military contractors and weapons manufacturers so that it can turn a profit. So on an individual level, you can divest your funds by changing your bank or your mutual fund institution. But the campaign is much larger than that. We're also looking at institutional divestment and government divestment. And so a concrete example would be divesting a university's funds from weapons manufacturers. Or it could be a hospital, a union, any business most likely has funds that invest somewhere. And the same thing on a municipal level in terms of divesting city public pension funds or even state or federal public pension funds.
It seems like a question of creating activist pressure, but also creating a culture where it's shameful to be invested in certain things, as with fossil fuels or Israeli occupations or anything else.
Exactly. And I think that that's also what's appealing to the quote-unquote youth or the millennials about divestment. And we've seen that the divestment movement thus far has been driven by millennials on college campuses, focusing specifically on fossil fuel divestment, but that we can build this up and expand it to include weapons divestment. And what's appealing to it is what you were alluding to about the sense that we're building an alternative culture. We're opting out of this negative industry, and then we're reinvesting it in something positive, whether that's education or healthcare or renewable energy. And so it's a way for us to take a tangible, concrete action step, which I think is much more appealing than certain actions that are symbolic, that sometimes people are tired of, you know, endless petitions or symbolic rallies.
Have we seen some victories already?
Well, we've seen massive victories for fossil fuel divestment, particularly with New York City. Mayor de Blasio just announced that the entire city of New York would divest from fossil fuels, which is something like $5 billion. And that's having ripple effects with mayors across the world who are taking similar action steps. I think that the weapons divestment campaign is very much in its infancy stages. And so we as organizers have to make these cross connections that we've been discussing and expand the movement to include military divestment.
We're speaking with Greta Szarö, who is our organizing director at World Beyond War, and my colleague, as I'm the director at World Beyond War. You can go to worldbeyondwar.org to learn more. Greta, it seems like part of the culture that makes it acceptable to be invested in weaponry is this culture that celebrates war and celebrates troops and celebrates veterans. And I know that there's a holiday coming up in the next days here that in the United States has become called Veterans Day, and in some other countries is still called Remembrance Day. But we're trying to get it called something else, right?
Absolutely, yes. November 11th coming up is Armistice Day, the 100th anniversary, in fact, of the end to World War I. And as you said, historically, it's been a day to celebrate the end to war. And unfortunately, in the United States, after the Korea War, we saw the renaming of Armistice Day to Veterans Day, and it became a day to glorify war instead. So we at World Beyond War have been advocating for reclaiming it as a day to celebrate peace. And if you go to worldbeyondwar.org, you can look at our global events map and find an Armistice Day celebration near you.
Very good recommendation. It's wonderful to hear World Beyond War described to me by you, Greta, so well. One of the other campaigns that I guess we're focusing on as well as divestment is related to bases, and I know that just after Armistice Day, I and Pat Elder and some others of us will be at a big conference in Dublin about closing bases. But how can you explain that campaign to people?
Yes. So building off what we were talking about with education as the core of our work at World Beyond War and teaching people about the strategies needed to demilitarize and manage conflict nonviolently. Once we educate, we then use that knowledge to mobilize and take action. And our two campaign priorities are divestment, as we've discussed, and the second one, closing military bases. And in particular, we're looking at U.S. foreign military bases and NATO bases, because the United States is the biggest culprit of this issue, with over 95% of foreign military bases around the world. And so the upcoming conference that you alluded to on November 16 through 18, we'll be talking about how to close U.S. and NATO military bases. You know, someone once described bases to me as the pushpins that hold up the map of empire. And I think that that's a really good analogy or symbol to have in our minds of one key reason why we're advocating for the closure of bases, because bases perpetuate this empire-building mentality that especially the United States is perpetuating. They are threats to countries. The U.S. is invading communities by staking its claim there, and we've also seen very grave environmental and social impacts in the communities where bases are located.
We have been, in fact, organizing more people since you've been involved, Greta, as our organizing director, and we had people reporting for the first time at the beginning of our annual conference, which, as you said, was in Toronto back in September, on what they're doing around the world. Someone from Japan, someone from New Zealand, and various locations around the world. Can you talk about how people are getting active in different countries, including increasingly now as a result of our conference in Canada?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So as I mentioned, a lot of our volunteers and chapters begin with holding educational events in their community first, building a shared understanding of these issues. And World Beyond War provides a really great source of materials that groups use to put on these events, the PowerPoints, books, study and discussion guide, videos and films. So a lot of our volunteers start out with holding those events in their communities, and we help them to develop the programming for the events and then to also recruit people and do the outreach to build those events up. And many of them, after they start out with that key foundational base, then they go on to do activism in their community based on the specific issues that they're facing in their neighborhood. So, for example, with our New Zealand coordinator, she's currently working on a petition to the New Zealand government, which is considering purchasing these military planes, war planes, that would cost millions and millions of taxpayer dollars for the New Zealand people and really to no benefit to them.
These aren't the same planes that we've been opposing in Burlington, Vermont, are they?
No, these are the P-8 planes. And Burlington, it's interesting you mentioned that, they're facing a similar campaign. Volunteers there are working to oppose the F-35 fighter jets, which are extremely noisy and would cause the foreclosure of many, many homes in the area where the planes are stationed because of the noise impact.
Yeah, it's a problem at U.S. bases around the U.S. and the world. So if somebody wants to start up a new World Beyond War chapter, how can they go about that?
Yeah, the easiest way is to contact me directly. My email is Greta, G-R-E-T-A, at worldbeyondwar.org, and send me an email and we'll start a conversation about what would work best in your community.
So you're spending a lot of time with these, with volunteers. Have any of them been coming up with ideas or activism or inspiring campaigns that others might want to emulate where they live.
Yes, that's a really good point. In addition to using our existing materials and campaigns, volunteers that we work with also come up with their own campaigns, again, based on what's relevant in their community or based on issues that they see and bring them to our attention. So right now I'm working with some volunteers in the state of Oregon in the United States to work on a national conscientious objector campaign, which would allow people to publicly declare their objection to serving in the U.S. military. And by making that public declaration, it helps if they are ever called to be drafted into the military, they can use that documentation to make a case for why they should not be drafted.
Excellent idea. I'm continually amazed, Greta, and I hope you can explain to people how you do it, because I think many people might want to do something similar if they thought it was possible. How you organize people online and around the world and around the United States off the grid in a what, 10-foot square, 20-foot square house on an organic farm in the middle of nowhere?
Well, that is the beauty of technology, and I think that's something that World Beyond War really illustrates very well, is that although technology can be used in negative ways, it can also be used in very positive, constructive ways. And just from my tiny home in, you know, a rural area of New York State, I'm able to connect using email and conference call with people literally all over the world, from Afghanistan, Pakistan, United States, Japan. And so really that technology helps me do it. And we have a solar panel system, which we use to power my laptop and phone.
It's still amazing to me, but I'm glad you're doing it. We also have been doing with you based there on the farm, we've been doing a number of webinars, which have the videos, as well as our conferences have the videos that people can still go and watch. And we have an online course, a more in-depth and personalized online course with more interaction with the instructors and so forth, coming up soon, right?
Yes, our online course is a 6-week course starting in February of 2019. And it will be going through those foundational topics that we've been discussing about how we can realistically move towards a world beyond war, the strategies needed to demilitarize and to cultivate this culture of peace. So you can go to worldbeyondwar.org to sign up for the course.
I hope a lot of people do, because a lot of our best volunteers and members of our coordinating committee, our volunteer committee that makes decisions for World Beyond War, have actually gotten involved through taking one of these courses in the past. We just have 5 minutes left, Greta. I wonder what has surprised you, encouraged you, discouraged you? What arguments do you run up against? I think we increasingly run up against the idea that the important thing to work on is the environment, so we must not be bothered with war or anything else. How do you deal with such hurdles?
Yeah, I think what's been very encouraging this year, it's the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, and we've seen the revival of the Poor People's Campaign. And that was very encouraging because it was going back to Martin Luther King's advice 50 years ago, talking about the interconnections of these issues, of what he called the three evils, economic injustice, militarism, and the environmental destruction, as well as racial injustice. So actually, there's a fourth one, which is the environmental destruction I mentioned that they added on with the 50th anniversary. And
right.
So this revival has really been encouraging for the movement because they are striving to do exactly what we have been doing at World Beyond War and what we hope to further expand across the movement, is showing how these issues are intimately interconnected. And if we're going to make progress on these issues, we have to be bridging these divides and working as a unified movement. And again, that really comes down to the war system, war and militarism being this block to any progress because of the massive amount of dollars that are used to perpetuate militarism at the expense of any other issue that we want to work on.
Well said. I think the fact that the Poor People's Campaign, like Black Lives Matter, from the start has been right about militarism and about these connections in a way that many, many coalitions are not, is a strong reason to support them. We also are looking, as you know, Greta, at April 4th, 2019, as a day to celebrate Martin Luther King and his philosophy of nonviolence, because, among other things, there's going to be a celebration of NATO in Washington, D.C. I understand, though, that NATO is good now because Trump is against it. Is that right?
That's an interesting logic. Unfortunately, when Trump seems to do something good, even a small positive baby step, such as supporting peace in Korea or, as you're saying, opposing NATO, because Trump is so wrong on so many issues, people are hesitant to encourage him even on these tiny positive baby steps. And I think that we shouldn't fall victim to that line of thinking and that we should encourage him to move forward on these issues that we do agree with.
Except we should hate Russia, right? I mean, Trump is Russia's servant, and we should. I mean, there's nothing really major at risk if we hate Russia, right?
That kind of thinking blocks us from moving as a unified movement together. We're looking to work with people all over the world. World Beyond War has signatories on our Declaration of Peace from 175 countries worldwide, including Russia. And so we can criticize maybe aspects of the Russian government and the way that it too props up militarism, but we cannot use that as an obstacle to block us from working together with the Russian people to advance peace worldwide.
Very, very well said. With 1 minute left, Greta Szarö, how can people get involved or learn more or find out if they're considering the possibility of getting slightly involved in trying to shut down the entire institution of war?
I would encourage people to go to our website, worldbeyondwar.org/individual, and there you can sign our Declaration of Peace, and there are multiple checkboxes you can choose to indicate how you'd like to get involved.
And very well said. You don't have to check any of them, but you should check one or more, and then we get back to you about getting you involved in that part of the campaign to end war. We've been speaking with Greta Szarö. She is organizing director of World Beyond War. The website is worldbeyondwar.org. You can click on About Us and Who Are We and read more about Greta Szarö and her work, and you can get involved in the campaign to abolish the worst thing that humanity does. Greta Szarö, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Safia Wazir fled Taliban rule in Afghanistan as a child and lived in a refugee camp in Uzbekistan for 10 years. As of Tuesday, she's in the state legislature of New Hampshire. Ilhan Omar left Somalia when she was 8 and lived for years in a refugee camp in Kenya before coming to the U.S. She's now an elected congressperson from Minnesota. U.S. government changed last Tuesday. The House added its youngest woman, New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and two Native American women, Deb Haaland and Sharice Davids, two Muslim women, Omar and Rashida Tlaib, the first Latinas from Texas, Sylvia Garcia and Veronica Escobar, and the first lesbian mother, Angie Craig, in Minnesota. Ayanna Pressley is the first Black woman Massachusetts has sent to Congress. Johanna Hayes, the first Connecticut has. So there's a lot to think about in terms of who won in the 2018 midterms. But there's also a lot to think about in terms of how we locate electoral politics in our efforts to change the world. As Phyllis Bennis and Reverend William Barber wrote, quote, "Elections are not how we change history, but they are a big part of how we, social movements, poor and disenfranchised and marginalized people, communities of color, engage with power," close quote. So Tuesdays in November, and what happens every other day of the year, is our topic today. We'll hear from Nagin Oliayi, inequality editor and researcher at the Institute for Policy Studies, and from civil rights attorney Liz O'Young of the New York Immigration Coalition about the fight over the 2020 census, which, if you don't know just how that relates to elections, well, you certainly should. Going forward after the midterms, this week on Counterspin. But first, a super quick look back at recent press. NBC News' headline, Midterms 2018, Voters Brave Long Lines to Cast Ballots. That sort of suggests a feel-good story about people's dogged commitment to democracy. But in reality, long lines are a sign of dysfunctional democracy, where votes are suppressed due to inadequate equipment and missing equipment and machines that switch votes and hours that are unhelpful for working people and polling places inaccessible to disabled people. As with every election, corporate media focused overwhelmingly on horse races, very meaningful, without doubt, but to the detriment of all of the other things elections push to the surface, including, preeminently, their insufficiency to fully capture the public's voice. 51% of the electorate did not vote in this most recent election. Journalism truly invested in democracy would be very busy figuring out why that happens and what it means. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The midterms are over, well, possibly not in a couple of places, and they involved some historic gains for diversity in Congress, though Republicans did bolster their strength in the Senate. But not all of the attention was on individuals running for office. Voters around the country also made choices about a range of ballot initiatives that can have major impact in their communities. Nagin Oliayi is an inequality editor and researcher at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Nagin Oliayi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I did want to talk about some of the kind of down ballot stuff, but I first wanted to just get your overall sense of these midterm elections in terms of the inequality issues that you track. Some of the winners were people who don't hesitate to use the word inequality, you know, and that seems good. What's your overall sense of the election's effect on that set of issues?
Yeah, I think we're still going to see how this story plays out over the course of the next couple of years. We've seen some really great games in some people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar. At the same time, we need to see how that translates into actual policies that help working people and make sure that we hold the wealthy accountable. So it's, I think, a little bit early to tell. But I also just like to emphasize that I think a lot of these people who are focusing on inequality issues, they're playing a really long game and it's working out. One of the things that I'd like to point to is the fact that, you know, voter suppression in states like Georgia and Florida is really impacting how politics is being played there. And so it's time for us to take that seriously as an issue. And one of the ballot initiatives that you mentioned in Florida, I think, will really do some work in making sure that people actually have a say in their own government.
Yeah, that's Amendment 4. Why don't you tell listeners who may not know what was so exciting about that and what that could mean?
I'm really excited about Amendment 4. It's in my home state of Florida. And basically what it's doing, it's repealing a Jim Crow era disenfranchisement law. The amendment got 64% of the vote in Florida, which is kind of, you know, shocking for people who are not familiar with the state, besides the fact that it comes up every few years in terms of recounts and, you know, being a swing state. But what it does is it'll restore access to voting rights to as many as 1.5 million people who have been convicted of felonies. And so that's a huge expansion in voting rights in the state.
You might even say Florida has artificially been kept a swing state by means of voter suppression that tamps down so many votes. And, you know, I think Amendment 4 was a great example of folks looking at an election and not talking about really personalities at all or who has a nicer smile or anything like that. You know, folks, I think, are ready to address issues in elections. And that, I think, is one of the more hopeful things, I guess, that I see.
Yeah, and I just want to say, too, on Amendment 4 in Florida, it's a long-time grassroots organizing effort that made that happen. You know, it's not something that started yesterday. It's something that's been in the works for some time, and I'm just really thrilled for all the people, the returning citizens who have worked on this, who are seeing their organizing pay off. So, again, yeah, it's something that is really deeply dependent on an issue. It's going to make a huge change for the electoral politics in terms of electing, you know, congressmen and governors and everything as well. But at the same time, it's something that appeals to the heart of fairness for Floridians.
Well, once we come out of elections, you know, there's a lot of horse race interest, and it's justified. But some of us focus more on the process itself and how representative actually is it, you know, and that's why things like Amendment 4 re-enfranchising felons in Florida, I think, is so important for folks who think that way. Well, another sort of general question, you had noted that in the last midterms in 2014, the Americans most likely to vote were those making more than $150,000 a year. And that obviously has some kind of impact. Do you see anything changing with that gap this time?
Well, it's a little bit too early to kind of make strong assumptions on those numbers just yet. But one thing that we did see was a huge turnout in the youth vote, which I think is going to make a huge difference. And I'd also like to point out some of the ballot initiatives that I think show what you can do to bring out working people to the polls. And that's two initiatives, particularly in Arkansas and Missouri. Voters in both states basically gave a raise to 1 million workers once you actually factor in everything. But they voted to raise the minimum wage in Arkansas and Missouri. In Missouri, they overturned a right-to-work amendment just earlier this year. And so when you ask people about the issues, they're really clear. You know, they want policies that are going to help working people, and they'll come out for those.
And to the extent that candidates talk about them, that can, you know, engage communities. Well, again, elections are about what happens afterwards and holding people accountable, you know, for promises that they've made. So are there other sort of down ballot things that you were looking at around the country in terms of inequality and, you know, that did or did not pan out, or even other races? I mean, I'm, of course, Kris Kobach, a big vote suppressor, losing in Kansas is meaningful, you know. So in terms of following the issue of inequality, were there other things in the landscape that you saw?
Yeah, I think in the Kansas race, you can see how just disastrous tax policies that have affected people in the state of Kansas for years now. People were really surprised by this race. But if you look at what the grassroots organizing that's been going on in Kansas, people talking about repealing tax measures, you know, that's been going on when the Republican push tax bill was going through Congress in 2017, for example, people in Kansas were coming out and saying, we don't want these policies in our own state. The federal government should not be adopting them, you know, on a national level. We'll see a slow repudiation of these ideas that in order to help working people, you need to lower taxes and lower corporate taxes. So I think that's definitely coming through in this election. And like I said, it's a long game. You know, it's not necessarily something that's going to change tomorrow. These are movements that we're talking about. It's not, you know, one race. It's about interacting with power.
Well, I feel the loss of local media here, you know, because a lot of the exciting things are happening at the state level, at the community level, you know, in state legislatures, for example. And big corporate media tend to focus mainly on the top of the ballot, and a lot of interest and organizing and change is happening below that. You know, do you have any thoughts about how media could help or could stop hurting on issues you care about?
I'd like to point to some races in California where the media really made an impact. California had a series of different propositions on a state level and on city level to address the housing and homelessness crisis. That, I mean, the UN came out with a report just last week saying that the treatment of homeless people in San Francisco is inhumane. It's a human rights violation. And so this is something that's really on the top of the minds of people who are living in California. And there's two things that I think show why we need the media to be looking at this. One of them is Proposition 10, which was blocked with the help of moneyed interest in California. And what that would have done, it would allow cities to impose their own rent control policies. Right now, the state as a whole is that the cities can't do that. It was targeted by private equity companies that are also acting as mass landlords in California. And one thing they did was, for example, Blackstone, which California's state teachers' pensions are invested in Blackstone. They were using that money to go against Proposition 10, which would have helped teachers in the state. So more attention to that earlier on, I think, would have been very important. But then on the flip side, you can see in San Francisco, they did pass Proposition C. And what that's going to do is it's going to raise taxes on businesses that have revenues greater than $50 million. And it got a lot of national attention. And that happened because basically a fight between two billionaires, Jack Dorsey and of Twitter and Square fame, and then Mark Benioff, who's the Salesforce CEO, who was really outspoken in support of Proposition C. And so it's not even necessarily the fact that you had this crisis of homelessness that's getting the attention of the media there. It was actually the fact that you had two billionaires kind of squaring off against each other to talk about whether or not this tax was appropriate. In terms of accountability, you know, this is one of those things where this tax has the ability to make sure that the tech companies that are profiting off of San Francisco are making sure that they're giving back to their communities as well.
Well, I thank you for highlighting that ground level work. I don't mean to be Pollyanna, but I do think that more information can mean more hope. You know, elections are crucial, of course, but not everything lives or dies by them. And a lot of work goes on, you know, on all those days that are not Tuesdays in November.
Absolutely. It shouldn't take billionaires to bring attention to the fact that there's a homelessness crisis and that there's a way to resolve it. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. The more information we can get about these ballot initiatives, the better as well.
We've been speaking with Nagin Oliayi. She is a inequality editor and researcher at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can find their work online at ips-dc.org. Nagin Oliayi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Van Newkirk at The Atlantic writes, quote, white nationalist groups decrying white genocide and fearing demographic shifts, anti-immigrant populism, the long reach of old Jim Crow, and plain old backroom political strategizing all come together here at the unlikely nexus of the census, because the census at its core is the key to democracy, close quote. Well, we're not accustomed to thinking of the 10-year survey as crucial in shaping our day-to-day lives. But if it weren't, it's unlikely that it would be being debated in federal court as it is right now. So what's going on? Liz O'Young is a longtime civil rights attorney and advocate and a consultant to the New York Immigration Coalition. She's also adjunct professor at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights and New York University's College of Arts and Science. She joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Liz O'Young.
Thank you very much. Thank you for including me.
Well, we won't assume that listeners know the fundamentals. It may have been a long time since civics class, and it's also not like we talk about the census very much. So what is the relationship between this survey and elections like last Tuesday. Why is the census so important in the Democratic project?
As you said, Janine, I can't underscore enough how the census means power and is the core of democracy, because it's based on the census results that redistricts are drawn. And as we saw, the importance of the Electoral College in the 2016 election, electoral votes are also distributed to different states according to census and population tallies. So it is absolutely critical. And the census, in addition to redistricting and the distribution of electoral votes, is so critical because $800 billion a year are distributed according to the census for the next 10 years. And so if you think about if you have a child that's age 5, critical services that they may need the next 10 years, whether it's good roads to get to their school, whether it's certain health benefits, educational, and other types of services where their hospital is located in their neighborhood, et cetera, is based on census results.
So why, then, is the New York Immigration Coalition in federal court, along with states and municipalities and other advocacy groups, why are you in federal court right now?
The current administration chose at the last minute to add a citizenship question to the decennial census. This will be a chilling factor on participation, especially given the last year and a half of unrelenting immigrant bashing by the highest office in this country. If there is a chilling factor like the citizenship question, certain people will not come out and complete that census. If they don't come and complete it, there will be an undercount. And that undercount is going to affect this whole nation, because every valid survey that's done always compares their results with the census. Businesses rely on census data as to where they employ their resources, to areas where populations have grown, jobs, et cetera, are dependent upon the census. And so if there is an inaccurate census because there's an undercount, that means the data will not be reliable. And it's based on that data that $800 billion a year is distributed across the country. We feel that the census is supposed to be nonpartisan. It's one of the few things that we as a nation can come together and do together to unify us. We need a count. It's a count of all persons living in the United States. And the 2020 census has been polarized. It has been politicized by the current administration. And that really puts the integrity, the credibility, the reliability of the census at stake.
Well, I would point out that people who work with polls like the Roper Center at Cornell University are upset about adding a question that asks, are you a citizen? Because they recognize that chilling effect that you're talking about. It's not really murky. There's every reason to imagine that if you ask a question about citizenship, that some people will not respond. And so folks who rely on polls, you know, are saying, well, that won't be real data. You know, we won't get actual information. And I just would underscore for folks that, as far as I understand it, the courts have said over the years that redistricting and congressional appointments should be based on population and not on citizen population, right?
That's correct. And Janine, not only experts in the field, but 6 prior census directors, Republican and Democrat, have advised the current administration, don't do it. Don't add this question. And they have gone ahead and done it anyway. And so I think that's pretty telling. And what's really about to hopefully come out in the trial soon is Secretary Ross of the Commerce Department, which oversees the census, has given inconsistent statements under oath as to his intentions as to why he put this citizenship question on there. The court trial right now that's going on is a consolidation of two cases, one by the New York Attorney General's office on behalf of 18 states. The other one was filed by ACLU, in which nonprofit groups are the plaintiffs, including New York Immigration Coalition, Make the Vote, et cetera. And the nonprofit organization's lawsuit, in addition to the claims raised by the New York Attorney General's office, has brought a claim for intentional discrimination, that our government has added this question deliberately to chill immigrant participation and to draw districts that favor Republican districts.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, as you've just said, he claimed to a congressional hearing that he was asked by the Justice Department to add this citizenship question, but then emails revealed that, in fact, he, in consultation with Steve Bannon and Chris Kobach, of all folks, sought to actually reintroduce that question himself. And it does matter. I think the way media carve things up is like there's a partisan thing happening at this top level, and then we're down in the neighborhoods. But of course, when people with clipboards show up at your door, it matters very much what sort of government they are seen as representing. And I don't think anyone would question that this is a White House that has made clear that they don't like non-white immigrants, documented, undocumented, naturalized, it doesn't matter. And that will translate to census takers.
Absolutely. And that has been raised in the trial so far, in the sense that the Census Bureau itself recognizes that a citizenship question is, quote unquote, a sensitive question. And Census Bureau's own research has shown that a citizenship question will decrease self-response rates. The difference that this trial is going to bear out hinges on whether or not the federal government's non-response follow-up plan to people who don't complete the census is an accurate substitute and an adequate substitute. So far, New York Attorney General's and ACLU witnesses that have gone forward so far are unanimous and feel that the federal government's efforts to deal with non-response is not adequate. You need someone who understands the community, who has the trust of the community, who has cultural competence, deal particularly with hard-to-count communities. And Census Bureau is having a difficult time recruiting those enumerators. And one of those issues is this administration is trying to do. Secondly, the Census Bureau is not allowing people who are green card holders, who are lawful permanent residents, to serve as enumerators. And in a city, for instance, like New York City, where you have so many different languages spoken, it is often people who are green card holders who have the ability to go from English to a non-English language and go back and translate from a non-English language back to English. And they're not allowed in the 2020 census to apply for the enumerator position. And so that is a barrier right there. In addition, other plans that the federal government has to deal with the expected decline in response rates because of adding the citizenship question are woefully inefficient. One is to go to proxies like the landlord. Well, the landlords may not be forthcoming of who lives in their apartment. Then they said they're going to use administrative records. Well, certain administrative records represent certain segments of our community better than others. For instance, if they use the city's financial records and taxes and so forth, certain groups may not be as well represented on those administrative records. They've tried to test it out, and in different parts of the city, there's been a 20% error rate. So, for instance, the administrative record may say that this housing unit is vacant, but when they went out, there were people living there. So there clearly needs to be more pre-testing with respect to the use of administrative records. The last thing that the federal government is planning to use is to help substitute for the self-response decline is imputation. That means look at other people in the neighborhood based on what their social demographics are, you impute that to the household that you weren't able to get information from. While in New York City, where you have many neighborhoods where there are multiple ethnicities and races, using the imputation is best used when you have homogeneity in a neighborhood. But if you have a lot of diversity in a neighborhood, that imputation is often going to lead to false positives. And so that's why it's critical that on the decennial census, when you only have like 10 or 11 questions, that you not have a question in there that's going to chill participation, because you want people to self-respond, because self-responses is the most accurate data.
Well, and so it sounds like a, you know, dry diagnostic question, but in fact, it's a really real, live, living question where getting it wrong is going to harm some people, you know, is going to punch in a particular direction. And I guess that's what folks are seeing.
Correct.
Well, what happens if federal courts decide that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross was within his power to add this question and they ignore the skullduggery behind it and it goes in? What kind of work will we need to do then?
We are optimistic that this question will be removed from the census. So far, all the evidence has pointed to its removal. Government's own research points to its removal, and we are optimistic that this will be removed. The government has not followed its own vetting procedures for putting a question on the census. They began, you know, way back as far as 2016 to begin to pretest these questions. The citizenship question has not been pretested. The one pretest that they did of the questions was in spring of this year in Rhode Island, and the citizenship question was not on there. There is glaring evidence that they have not followed their own procedures, and so I think we have a strong case, and we are optimistic that this question will be removed from the 2020 census.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Liz O'Young, civil rights attorney and advocate and consultant to the New York Immigration Coalition, also adjunct professor at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights and NYU's College of Arts and Science. Liz O'Young, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are forests releasing their carbon wealth to the sky? Should we fear a new burst of warming and extreme weather due to record wildfires? I'll ask atmospheric scientist John C. Lynn from Utah. From the UK, Dr. Edward Hanna tells us why unusual air pressure over Greenland can ruin European summers and pump up sea levels. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where reality comes out through science. In 2018, vast plumes of smoke erupted into the atmosphere from very large wildfires on a couple of continents. Will that make global warming worse? I've called Professor John C. Lynn from the Land-Atmosphere Interactions Research Group at the University of Utah. After studying and teaching in Canada, John Lynn got his doctorate in Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard. He is widely involved in the scientific community, including his role as a science team member with NASA. And Lynn is author or co-author of 10 peer-reviewed papers published just so far in 2018 alone. From Salt Lake City, Professor Lynn, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, it's a joy to join you today.
All right, so I'm hoping to get an atmospheric view of this wildfire story. What happens when a large forest apparently vaporizes into the air?
A lot happens. We're all probably familiar with what happens on the ground. The various parts of the vegetation burn up or almost disappear, leaving a very charred landscape behind. But also a lot happens in the atmosphere. So different things get released into the atmosphere. So that includes the different aerosols that we call the particles that make it to the atmosphere. There's also various, I would say, pollutants that affect human health. There's also, of course, the greenhouse gases. The carbon that was stored in the form of wood and leaves in the vegetation get vaporized and they get turned into carbon dioxide. So that is a greenhouse gas that I'm sure you've talked many times in your program.
And this year in the journal Atmosphere, you and your colleagues published a paper about the difficulties of modeling forest fire smoke. What is the problem?
Well, the forest fires themselves generate heat, and that causes the atmosphere around the fires itself to change. So that causes sometimes pretty extreme what we call pyrocumulus clouds, that clouds that extend very high into the atmosphere. And that is often very difficult to model. So that's one example. Another way to think about it is the fires create its own weather. And that could affect exactly how far downwind the smoke plume reaches.
Well, I know when volcanoes erupt or even when nuclear reactors blow up, we know that a key factor is whether the particles and gases manage to rise as high as the stratosphere. John, why is that important?
Absolutely, yeah. The stratosphere, which is the layer of atmosphere above the lowest part of the atmosphere, which is the troposphere, so that layer is more stable. So if the particles from fires or volcanoes make it up to the stratosphere, they can hang around for a while. So there are famous examples like after the eruption of Mount Pinatubo, where the aerosols hung around for a year or two, and that caused a global cooling effect. So that is one of those very dramatic global phenomena that persisted for a year or two, but eventually these particles do go away. And we're back.
Do you know if that happened in this fire season this year?
I'm not aware of huge amounts of aerosols making it to the stratosphere from the fires. Those huge events from the fires are more on the rare side. So typically the smoke does still stay within the troposphere. So then they dissipate relatively quickly.
But this past summer, even in the troposphere, the smoke from the giant wildfires in Siberia was reported to have blown 5,000 miles across Canada as far as New England. Does that strike you as unusual transport in the atmosphere?
So those do happen, and that happens even if it doesn't make it into the stratosphere. What you're describing is sort of long-range transport across the Pacific does happen even if the plume makes it only in the upper part of the troposphere. So maybe, I would say, over 10 kilometers above sea level. So that can still happen without making it all the way to the stratosphere.
And where does the ash and soot from wildfires in the northern hemisphere tend to end up? Do we know?
Were you thinking about fires, say, from Canada or?
Yes, Canada and the boreal or in Siberia. Does it all go up to the Arctic and blacken glaciers and ice there or not?
That does happen, but plenty stay at lower latitudes as well. In fact, there's some emergent sort of research from different groups looking at long-term trends of these kind of particles, and there appear to be an increasing trend in these extreme events in the western U.S., for example, most likely due to fire. So there's a very likely scenario of increasing sort of fire activity, large, intensive fires happening. I know B.C. was kind of a record year this year, right? I think it's, isn't it the sort of the most amount of burned area?
Yes, it either is this year or it tied with last year.
Yeah, these 2 years are quite pronounced, yeah.
We've had fire emergencies both years, and I personally, as my listeners are tired of hearing about, was smoked out for a couple of weeks, and we had fires right up on the hill above our house and so on. But anyway, you did mention a lot goes on when these fires happen, and I wanted to just touch on a couple of the lesser-known gases. I know that wildfires produce a lot of carbon monoxide. I've seen NASA maps showing huge spots of carbon monoxide. There was one right here in British Columbia during our fire emergency last summer. How long does carbon monoxide last in the atmosphere?
Carbon monoxide, or CO as we call it, lasts on the order of a month, depends on the season, but I would say a good rule of thumb is about a month. So it's not, I would say, super long-lived compared to some other gases, but it does hang around for a bit. Mainly it gets oxidized to CO2 eventually.
So can carbon monoxide also affect the climate?
In the sense that it eventually shows up as carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas that we are talking about. Yeah, so in the form of carbon monoxide or eventually CO2, the fires definitely produce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So that is definitely a warming effect that one should think about from the fires. And perhaps this is a good time maybe to talk about your original questions. What is the sort of net effect potentially of fires, warming or cooling? And that's where the discussion gets more complicated, because while the fires release a fair bit of greenhouse gas, they also have other effects. It depends on the time scale you're talking about. So it affects the landscape. The forests sometimes take quite a while to grow back after the fire. So then the question is, what happens to the landscape that it leaves behind? And perhaps surprisingly to some people, it could have a cooling effect. And that actually happens in some of the more northern latitudes, like in Canada, because the forests actually are less reflective than the landscape that they leave behind after they burn up. So there could paradoxically be almost a cooling effect from that perspective. So there are these competing effects from the greenhouse gases to the more reflective landscape that it leaves behind. So that's where careful calculations have to be done.
And what about the dimming effect from the smoke itself? I mean, it was cold here when it was densely packed with smoke.
So definitely there is a cooling effect perhaps right in the vicinity of the fire. The smoke can really block out the sun, yeah? So there's sort of a local cooling effect that would dissipate after a while as well. So that cooling effect wouldn't necessarily last. So the IPCC has done some careful calculations of the net effect of these aerosols that the fires emit. And there's sort of, it's kind of a cancellation. There's some cooling, but also some warming. And the last IPCC report arrived at what they call radiative forcing of roughly zero. So those are washing up. But the other effect I'm talking about, this albedo effect, the reflectivity of the ground, that can persist for a while because, as I said, the vegetation takes a while to grow back. And if we're thinking about the more northern latitudes, the formerly darkened surface would be turned into a reflective surface, especially if there's snow on the ground. So that's where perhaps you can see where this cooling can come from.
And another idea I've had, which is very unscientific, and I'm hoping you can help me out with it, is whether, I mean, we have a burst of carbon coming out of these fires as the tree trunks release all their carbon and goes into the air. Now, when that carbon arrives in the air, do we have an immediate heating effect, like a greenhouse effect, or does it take time for that to really happen?
Are you saying the carbon dioxide, does that immediately get to work in terms of trapping infrared radiation? Is that where we're getting at?
Yeah,
so that can take place pretty quickly, but we're well aware of the fact that that burst of carbon dioxide gets mixed really rapidly. So carbon dioxide is often referred to as well-mixed greenhouse gas. So while it's true that, let's say, in downtown Vancouver or right downwind of a fire, the carbon dioxide would be elevated, that relative increase is not that big compared to the background amount. So while it's true that it would get to work, but that effect is not that big. Yeah, so that net heating. But the aerosols, that cooling effect that you felt, I think you talked about, that could be felt pretty locally, very quickly. But that additional warming from the carbon dioxide is not that pronounced.
Well, thank you. That helps.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Professor John C. Lynn from the University of Utah. We're talking about wildfires, the atmosphere, and climate change. So in 2009, the respected Tasmanian fire scientist David Bauman published a paper where he estimated that fires of all kinds, including agricultural burning, produced greenhouse gases equivalent to 50% of human emissions. But other sources tell me that relatively low carbon contribution from wildfires in the U.S. compared to overall emissions. John, does carbon release from wildfires really matter compared to our fossil fuel burning?
Absolutely. If you're thinking about a global scale, and again, it depends on where you are. Let me go to some of the big fire releases. Indonesia is an example. So the amount of, I think, carbon dioxide released in the recent El Nino event, which was a huge one, the 2015-2016 event from Indonesia, was really big. I think there was a study that showed it rivaled some of the biggest fossil fuel emitting nations in the world just from fires alone from Indonesia. So that was quite a big event. So it does matter in the global sense. There are very big releases of carbon from wildfires. And these days, the biggest are in the tropics, like Indonesia or in the Congo in Brazil, for example, around the Amazon forest. So while they may not be as big in total as the total, let's say, combustion from coal or gasoline or natural gas, wildfire release is still very big, the same order of magnitude.
I was surprised when looking into this to find out how much of the planet does burn from time to time. A 2008 study of fires led by a Spanish scientist named Emilio Chuvieco, I hope I pronounced that correctly, found more than 30% of the global land surface has a significant fire frequency. So, I mean, almost a third of the planet burns from time to time. That must add a lot of urgency to the work that you and other atmospheric scientists are doing to track what this really means.
Yes. Yes, and this year was a big fire year in the western U.S., and as we just discussed, in British Columbia as well. The Western U.S., I should now say Western North America, is undergoing a fair bit of change, I think. And I should add that intersects with other sort of effects of climate change. And one big one is the insect damage that's affecting the forests of Western North America. The beetle kills leaves a lot of fuel that can lead to catastrophic fires. And you add on top of that human suppression of wildfires over decades, and that leads to a lot of fuel sort of build up. So even from the perspective of just safety and air quality, wildfires have a big impact. So that is not necessarily climate per se, but it certainly intersects with all the other consequences of climate change.
Well, let's talk about some of your other work. And on each Radio EcoShock show, we try to dive into the deep end at least once and maybe drown. So you are the editor of a book on Lagrangian modeling of the atmosphere. Who is Joseph-Louis Lagrange, and why are you specializing in this work developed in Prussia in the 1700s?
Well, it's Mr. Lagrange, but he's a smart guy, so his name shows up in a lot of things. So this Lagrangian book that I was involved in, and that we make heavy use of, is talking about specific kind of modeling of the atmosphere. And the way it works is there are two basic kinds of modeling that takes place in the atmosphere. One is called Eulerian, named after another famous guy, Euler. And the way that works is you stay stationary, you observe and try to model the atmosphere as it passes you. The other is you go along with the flow in the atmosphere, and that's the Lagrangian kind of modeling that I'm involved in with a lot. And that kind of model can be used to trace wildfires, today's topic. It could be used to trace plumes of pollution and nuclear accidents, all sorts of stuff. So it's been a very, very useful way to understand the atmosphere. One interesting sort of perspective that my group has taken is to do the atmospheric modeling backward in time and try to trace where the air that we measure comes from. So that becomes really useful. Let's say we want to understand where the smoke that we breathe, let's say in Vancouver, comes from. So we trace the air backward in time using the Lagrangian method. We can map out specific parts of the landscape that contributed to that pollution. So that's the kind of application of the Lagrangian modeling.
Yes, we found that we got some dust from eastern China by that kind of research, I think.
Yeah. It's very widely used now, those kind of models.
And I've also noticed, John, that some of the work published by you and your research group is local. It's about Utah. And I'm wondering, maybe that's where the new climate science is going, that we need less now about these grand global averages and more of a focus on the direct impacts where we are.
Yeah, I think that's been perhaps a bright spot, even in the policy realm as well. So as we all know, the federal action on climate in the U.S. has been
pathetic,
kind of quiet in recent years. But there's been a lot of action on the grassroots level, at the local municipal level as well. Lots of cities in North America and beyond around the world have very ambitious, say, climate mitigation plans. A lot of cities, let me just take Salt Lake City example, have very ambitious plans. Salt Lake City is trying to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 80% in a few decades. So 80%, that's a very ambitious plan. So that's where this local research can hopefully help inform and assess different means to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Just as a really basic example, we're measuring carbon dioxide around the city of Salt Lake City. It's actually one of the longest-running urban CO2 monitoring networks in the world. So from that perspective, we can measure from the atmosphere how much carbon dioxide is being pumped into Salt Lake City's atmosphere, and we can see how it's changing over time. And if cities have sort of very ambitious plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then we should be able to measure it in the atmosphere. So that's kind of a, I think, exciting new front in the climate research, becoming quite local and potentially engaging the stakeholders and policymakers as well. And once we're talking about, say, city scale, there's a lot of opportunity to engage the public or different people because we all understand different parts of the city, and that's where we can also tie in with sort of people's individual efforts to try to help.
Have we reached the point yet where any of our listeners can look up how much CO2 is coming from their city?
It's getting there, and there are some nice websites I can share with you. I can dig it up and email it to you at some point. There are some estimates of different cities' emissions. And I believe where you're at, Vancouver, is also there's a fair bit of work done on that front. Some people at University of British Columbia that I know have done similar kinds of work. So, yeah, it's sort of a growing field. There's a fair bit of action on the urban front. There's hope that this is where the research and the public and the different stakeholders can really meet.
Well, great. If you'd send me those links, I'll put them in my show blog. And I'm also going to look in to see whether Europe is doing the same thing. There's a lot of work that could come from that and some activism, as you say. Now, John, when I talk with scientists in various fields, I'm beginning to sense a kind of race developing. And that race is between greenhouse gases produced directly by us humans versus a whole collection of carbon sources and feedbacks coming directly from nature. Right now, we're the biggest polluter, but do you think nature could take over as the major engine of further warming?
I really hope not, because we're already pumping a lot of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So there are some worries. There are some big stores of carbon, for example, that could be destabilized as climate change occurs. Examples include the tropical rainforest, the Amazon, for example, lots of carbon there. There are some climate models that do predict as the climate warms, it could also get drier in the Amazon. And there are some climate models that simulate catastrophic kind of collapse of the Amazon rainforest, which means all that carbon is going to be released to the atmosphere. So that those are really cases where the natural emissions could potentially rival those of the humans. I hope not. There's also the carbon that are found in the permafrost or peatlands in Canada, let's say. If those do melt and dry out, that could also be a big pulse of carbon to the atmosphere. So, yeah, so the potential is there. I'm hoping we don't get there. But I think you're right. There's sort of a general concern. Sometimes it's referred to as tipping points, where you have very large changes that could happen. Still sort of instigated by the human release, but where the natural could have a big response to that.
John, do you think it's fair to say the atmosphere is more complex and fragile than we knew?
It's definitely more complex. I might shy away from fragile, but it's complex, and it responds in ways that could be surprising. And clouds, for example, is another great example. I believe you just talked to my colleague, Tim Garrett, right?
That's right, yes.
And the clouds are a perfect example. There's lots of things that affect clouds, and whether clouds are warm or cool or increase in extent or decrease depends a whole host of variables, including wildfires, which could affect clouds. So it is definitely very complicated, but it makes it interesting as well.
And there's rivers of air up there. I just watched a video from University of Ottawa scientist Paul Beckwith, and he was showing this Beaufort Sea gyre both in the atmosphere, but then that starts to spin the sea below it. So there's a real interaction, and I think your team name shows that, between both the earth and the air, but also the sea and the air.
Oh, yes. And my colleague here, Thomas Reichler, also shows the coupling between the stratosphere and these lower layers. So these layers are seem somewhat separate, but they can be coupled, and that makes it even more complicated and interesting.
And as we finish up here, what are some of the other things you're working on these days?
One thing I'm working on is dust. So I would like to understand the transport and the origins of dust. Again, using these Lagrangian models we talked about. But there's a fair bit of concern about a dust transport in the western U.S. And some of that is due to some of the lakes potentially drying up. We have a big one next door called the Great Salt Lake. And right now, the aerial extent of the Great Salt Lake is quite low. And that's a combination of human use of water that flows into the lake and also climate change. And that could expose lake beds that could have dust emissions to the atmosphere. And then the dust in the atmosphere, once it's deposited on snow, we're finding out could melt it at a faster rate. And that could be a feedback loop as well. So that's been one other project that I've been working on right now. And another project I'm working on is the use of satellites to determine the carbon emissions from cities from around the world. So NASA has a satellite called OCO2, Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, that's orbiting the Earth, measuring carbon dioxide from around the world. So we're trying to make use of that to figure out how much emissions are happening in different parts of the world. And pretty soon, next year, NASA will be launching OCO3, which will be on the International Space Station. And that will be pretty exciting because that sensor is somewhat different. It'll be able to look at individual cities in detail and really tell us much more about what different cities are emitting.
From the University of Utah, we've been speaking with John C. Lynn, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences. I'll put links to John's webpage and some key papers we've discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. With 18 peer-reviewed papers out this year and more in press, John, are you the kind of person who eats lunch in your office?
Uh-oh, how did you guess? I do. But that's partly because my wife brings me wonderful lunches, so I get to enjoy it in my office, too.
Well, thank you for spending your valuable time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a joy.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What can steer a hurricane into New York City, drive rotten wet summers in the UK and Northern Europe, and change sea level around the world? Here's a hint. It is something you cannot see happening in a place that never appears on your network news weather map. The answer to the question, and more, arrives in our interview with Dr. Edward Hanna, Professor of Climate Science and Meteorology at the University of Lincoln. From the Cathedral City of Lincoln in North England, Dr. Hanna, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Well, frankly, at first glance, I thought your new paper might be outside the interest of a general audience. The title sounds very science-oriented, but there are at least six very large developments almost hidden in this work. What got you looking at the atmosphere over Greenland, and what is blocking?
So I've been working on Greenland climate and ice glaciology matters for about the last 20 years or so, initially actually mainly on looking at changes in the balance of its ice sheet, so consequences for sea level rise and so on, but also with respect to its climate as well, because obviously the two factors are quite closely linked. So it's something I've been working on and quite passionate about for a number of years now, and certainly we've seen some big changes recently In terms of blocking, well, this is essentially a high pressure that sticks around a certain part of the Earth's surface for a number of days or even up to a few weeks or so. So it's high air pressure or atmospheric pressure that you would typically measure with a barometer at Earth's surface. Not always, but typically we're looking at data near Earth's surface. And the whole point of the blocking is that it will actually can disrupt the normal air circulation in the atmosphere. So where you've got jet stream, for example, then that can get diverted or weakened by these kind of blocking conditions.
So if we have a barometer at home, what is high pressure or low pressure actually measuring?
So you're measuring the column of atmospheric mass above where you're measuring that air pressure, and that's really reflecting circulation conditions and changes in the in the general atmosphere, not necessarily just obviously above the point where you're measuring. Essentially, where you've got higher pressure, this is linked with subsiding air near the surface, so you've got a denser mass of air near the surface. It tends to be, on average, more stable weather conditions. Low pressure is the measure of the surface. It is more typically linked with very disturbed weather conditions and things like cyclones that are commonly associated with the jet stream.
Well, Greenland's pretty far away from us. Why is atmospheric pressure over Greenland so influential on weather in the Northern Hemisphere?
Well, it's quite interesting because we have the jet stream over the North Atlantic area that includes Greenland. Normally, the jet stream flows south of Greenland, but when you have what we call blocking or high pressure developing over Greenland, this can interact with the jet and push it further south. Sometimes it can actually bifurcate the jet, so it sometimes actually passes north over Greenland as well. But it's like a giant stone in a river. When you have this blocking conditions over Greenland, it can actually divert the airflow over much larger regions over the North Atlantic. So it does have consequences well beyond the island itself.
Well, we're all aware that under pressure from advancing climate change, scientists around the world are contributing to very complex models. And one of the holy grails of that whole process was to move from prediction about a global mean or average to advising governments about regional trends that will come up, say, in the next decade or so. What did those modelers miss?
So I think in terms of climate models, they work really well at the global level and even down to a continent scale level. The issue is when you're looking at regional phenomena processes that are operating at subcontinental or smaller scales, and this can include blocking over still quite large areas like Greenland, as well as things like the jet stream, that actually the jet's an incredibly narrow feature quite often, just a few tens of kilometres wide in its main core, that the models can have problems actually capturing some of these smaller scale features in terms of their characteristics and how they vary. So I think if you're looking at any one place on the Earth's surface, obviously it's local weather that we experience in terms of climate change. Depending on where you are, if you're near one of these regional features that's not well represented by the models, then you've got a bit of a problem in predicting the more local scale aspects, if you like, of future climate change. So I think the models are great for the large scale, but somewhat more problematic for the local to regional scale in certain, quite often, key regions.
And it seems to me that your paper finds that what the scientists have been predicting would happen for atmospheric pressure over Greenland is almost the opposite of what observations really show is happening.
Yes, so the models have actually air pressure not changing very much or slightly weakening over the, you can run the models backwards in time for the last 50 years or so, which we've looked at data from such runs of the models retrospectively, but also obviously forward, so forecasts or predictions of the models for the rest of this century. Now, these show a greater reduction in air pressure or blocking over Greenland. What we've seen from the observations for the last 30 years, so since about the 1980s or so, certainly since 1990, is a very strong and significant increase in air pressure over the Greenland region in summer, I should emphasize, not really in the other seasons. So there's been greatly enhanced blocking over Greenland in summer. And if you look at the historic data from the models, that does not show up at all in the climate models.
So if we look at the impact of global warming on the jet stream, which you've discussed a little bit so far, what else have you found in relation to Greenland? What happens with the jet stream?
So what happens is that as you get, you have more or increased blocking over Greenland in summer, this tends on average, not all the time, but more often to push the jet stream further south over the North Atlantic region. And also at times that jet stream can weaken as well. So that then affects other regions further south of Greenland, such as the UK. But again, it's the point that blocking over Greenland is not an isolated phenomenon, but it also can affect things like the jet stream and other aspects of climate regionally downstream of Greenland that then affects extreme weather conditions and potentially climate change over those more southerly latitudes.
But the jet stream could be weakening due to other causes, such as disappearing summer sea ice, a connection observed by Jennifer Francis of Rutgers and others. True?
Yes, I mean, certainly we've seen big changes over the Arctic region recently, and I do believe, I mean, there's a number of studies done that suggest that Arctic sea ice reduction, very dramatic in summer in the last 10, 20 years, and the changes that we've been discussing over Greenland are kind of not independent of each other. And you're perfectly right that there's a number of driving influences on the jet stream, including potentially these large Arctic sea ice reductions that could also potentially weaken the jet stream. Now, that is a somewhat still controversial area in climate science. There seems to be some fair evidence from observations that this may be happening, but it needs a lot more further work. But of course, then there's actually a lot of other factors affecting the jet stream as well.
So in the news, I hear about Greenland blocking in storms like Hurricane Sandy. It seemed that hurricane was forced to make a left turn into New York City because of a blocking pattern further north. And in fact, the American Meteorological Society has announced a presentation on just that. The title is A Climatological Assessment of Greenland Blocking During Hurricane Sandy and Its Influence on North Atlantic Hurricane Tracks. How could invisible changes to the atmosphere over Greenland affect weather in the eastern United States?
Well, when you have increased high pressure or blocking sticking around for longer over Greenland, this tends to divert the jet stream near the eastern U.S., so in the western part of the North Atlantic, from what's normally a west-to-east pattern. I mean, it never moves entirely in a straight line, but then it's much more moving from south to north. When these hurricane systems get caught up in the jet stream flow as they move further north from the Caribbean or wherever they initially form, then they get caught up in that airflow, and instead of recurving out eastwards over the North Atlantic, they can actually end up being forced the opposite way. I mean, this was a very special event, but it does certainly seems plausible that with these large-scale changes in the jet stream, it will affect some of the extreme weather events, such as what you mentioned. So I think that's entirely plausible. And also, there's been some previous studies published on the Sandy case study by some pretty reputable Greenland climate scientists as well. So that's actually really interesting.
So it seems your research suggests that predictions for the future weather in the UK and Europe may be incorrect because they don't include this factor of atmosphere over Greenland, correct?
Well, certainly it's a distinct possibility. I must say that we cannot, of course, be sure about this because there is a lot of natural variability in the climate system. So we cannot discount the possibility that the disagreeing trends, if you like, between in blocking over Greenland between the climate models and observations may be a shorter-term blip. But I certainly think that 30 years is a sufficiently long time to flag this quite major discrepancy that potentially that could carry on. And in that case, I think there are serious issues with some of the climate predictions at the more regional level over parts of Northwest Europe.
With those changes over Greenland, Edward Hanna, is it more likely the UK will experience more wet summers as you endured in 2007 and 2012?
I certainly think this is a distinct possibility again, although you wouldn't expect this every summer. And in fact, the summer just passed, so 2018, has been a record warm and dry summer over large parts of the UK. But I'd just like to point out that in the last 100 years, 2007 and 2012, were two of the wettest summers in England and Wales. And I do think that is not unrelated to the increase we've seen in Greenland blocking. What happens is that as the jet moves further south, over the North Atlantic, it normally actually misses most of the UK in the summer, except for a bit near the Scotland, but it's actually come further south and in those 2 years, so that it's actually caused a lot of incessant rain-bearing systems to form and pass over England and Wales in 2007 and 2012.
Well, let's say England moves from three and such washouts, summer washouts in 100 years to 20. That would make a huge difference in the tourism industry, and maybe even agriculture in Northern Europe could be affected.
Absolutely. I mean, it's also got to do with the potentially increased variability if we have more variable conditions, which are also incidentally really hard to predict still in summer compared with winter. I mean, there's still the availability currently of cheap package holidays, relatively speaking, for people in the UK. So, I mean, it's fairly easy for people for many people to go abroad locally in Europe, but to places where the climate is seen as more reliable if it's seen as less reliable in the UK. Also, I mean, there'd be other industries, food production, agriculture. I mean, I've been looking at wheat yield productions, and we could certainly see more significant drops in those if we have more record wet summers. So that's quite interesting as well.
Do we actually have enough now, though, to change long-term weather trends for Northern Europe, or do we just still need to learn a lot more in this rather amorphous prediction of future weather?
For improving the long-range forecast. So that's something that I'm currently working with other people, both here in Lincoln and elsewhere as well, on currently. I think that in terms of decadal predictions, so for the next, say, 1 to 2 decades, I think we do need to understand more about whether this increase in Greenland blocking, how significant that is in terms of whether it's likely to be sustained. If it is, then I think we do need to revisit some of the regional model predictions of climate change at the country or smaller level for parts of Northern Europe, because the whole point is that if we have even more or increased blocking over Greenland in future or more often, then I think we will expect these more rain-bearing systems, not just over the UK, but some neighbouring parts of Northwest Europe as well.
If we grab a selection of some of the best climate models right now, can we predict the future of climate changes over Greenland itself?
From the current models, and I think this is fairly evident when we look at the IPCC level predictions, there's a huge range of projections, which is even perhaps slightly larger over Greenland than globally. I do feel that model predictions for Greenland of its regional climate, so the warming for the rest of this century, may potentially underestimate the future change if the models, as it seems, may not properly include this sort of blocking phenomenon in within them. So I think there certainly is potential that we're underestimating future warming in Greenland. We can't tell for sure, but we think this merits further work.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. With me is Professor Edward Hanna, a specialist in climate science and meteorology at Britain's University of Lincoln. We're talking about how climate change and air pressure over Greenland can change many things in this world. So what does atmospheric pressure over the continent of Greenland have to do with the rate and amount of melting on the surface of that frozen continent?
So if you have more high pressure or blocking conditions over Greenland, as I pointed out before, this can divert the jet stream, drag warmer air further north up over the ice sheet, which will cause more surface melting of the ice, and so you'll have more mass being lost from the ice sheet each year and contributing to global sea level rise ultimately. And there's also weather conditions that are linked in with that extra high pressure over Greenland, which may mean clearer skies quite often in summer, so you can have more radiation or energy from the sun actually melting surface ice and snow. So I think you'd expect increased melting and increased loss of mass from the ice sheets.
Okay, now we know that GRACE satellites going over Greenland tell us that the continent is rapidly losing mass as the ice melts. And here's an oddball question from a non-scientist. Does a change in the mass of a continent have any effect on the mass of the atmosphere above it?
Well, I certainly think there can be some small-scale effect. It's not something that I'm directly looking into myself, but I think I've certainly been looking quite closely at the GRACE data, and the interesting thing there is that we've got an accelerating loss of mass from Greenland over the last 20 years. It's something like 250 billion tonnes per year of net mass loss from Greenland. Although it's very dangerous to project trends into the future, that's really highlighting the increasing contribution to sea level that Greenland's recently made.
So how does sea level rise connect with your new research about Greenland?
Well, if we have, as we've observed, increased high pressure over Greenland, more blocking in the last few decades, then we think that that has contributed to increased melting, mass loss of the ice sheet, and therefore it's likely to exacerbate sea level rise and may already have been doing so, in fact. So currently sea level is rising at about 3.5 millimetres per year. Greenland is contributing perhaps two-thirds of a millimetre per year, possibly a bit more, but certainly possible that will keep increasing slightly, although it's very uncertain with how the solid ice parts of Greenland respond to increased warming. So basically there's a significant contribution from Greenland. It could have been enhanced through these climatological changes that we've been speaking about.
I've been speaking with at least a dozen other scientists who presume a higher sea level rise than projected by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Would you care, Edward, to enter that guessing game? How high do you think the seas might rise by the year 2100?
Well, I mean, I think there's obviously many uncertainties, but we're already seeing significant sea level rise globally. I mean, although it's nearer the top-end projections, I mean, 1 metre by 2100 compared with recent values seems a distinct possibility. And we can't discount the possibility that we could get somewhat more than that. Although, as I say, I think these are upper-end projections. I mean, people have been talking about 1.5 metres. It's unlikely, in my opinion, to be much more than that. But there's still a lot of things that we don't understand. So certainly I think the IPCC estimates of sea level rise for the rest of this century, at least the ones that were published a few years ago, are possibly somewhat conservative compared with what we might actually witness during the rest of this century.
Well, I try to squeeze in at least one science nerd question per interview, and here's this one. What is the North Atlantic Oscillation, and how does that relate to atmospheric pressure over Greenland?
So the North Atlantic Oscillation is basically measuring a difference in air pressure north-south, or south-north, rather, across the North Atlantic. So imagine you had two barometers. One is in the Azores Islands in the middle of the North Atlantic, off the coast, some hundreds of kilometres off the coast of Portugal, and you have another barometer in Iceland, and you're measuring air pressure from both of them at the surface, and you're taking the difference of the Azores minus Iceland. So that pressure gradient is really giving you an idea of how active the jet stream is across the North Atlantic. So when the jet stream is more active, you've got a larger difference between the Azores and Iceland, and the reverse is also true. So basically, this is really a kind of an approximation of jet stream and the strength of the westerly winds across the North Atlantic. Now, the point is that when the jet stream's stronger, so when you have a greater pressure gradient between the Azores and Iceland, so it tends to be high pressure over the Azores, low pressure over Iceland is when you have this strong pressure gradient, then you tend to have low pressure over Greenland. It's not always true, but there is a reasonably strong correlation between, Greenland blocking and the North Atlantic Oscillation. So positive NAO or a strong NAO, you tend to have low pressure over Greenland. A low NAO, you have the opposite with high pressure or blocking conditions over Greenland.
Okay, now, given that that is an oscillation, how fast has the atmospheric system over Greenland changed? And are we sure it will not, as President Trump said recently about climate change, that it will not change back?
Well, we're not sure. That's a point that we do make in our study. So I always think that it's good to use the observational data as a baseline. So I have actually, with my team, we've constructed a estimate of blocking changes over Greenland for the last 170 years or so. And from those data, which are based largely on observations, it's something called reanalysis data, which is very widely used by climate scientists. It's basically a gridded product based on observations, that certainly the changes in the last 10 to 20 years, or up to 30 years in summer, are unique in the last 170 20 years. So we've had record values of Greenland blocking, and those changes have been comparatively rapid in the last 10, 20 years or so, although there are also year-to-year quite large variations as well. So actually 2013, well, we had a record Greenland blocking in 2012, and then a year later in summer also in 2013, actually it went the other way. So there are variations on different timescales, but the trends seem to be quite unique in the last few decades. We're not sure that it won't change back. We need to understand more about the climate system at the Greenland regional scale. But you would kind of expect that as conditions warm over Greenland, all other things being equal, then warmer air masses tend to be linked with higher pressure air masses as well. So with all the changes going on around the ice sheet in Greenland, also, as you mentioned, loss of sea ice around the edges of Greenland, that you would also, that there are good physical reasons for expecting air pressure on average, not all the time, but on average to increase over Greenland.
So you've done classic science in this paper, comparing model predictions to measured reality. Should we trust climate modeling less, or does your work point to the need to keep refining those models?
Well, I think it's kind of a bit of both, but I would emphasize the latter. So we do need to keep working on the models, which, as I said before, they work pretty well at the global or even at the continent scale, but are less reliable once you go to the sub-regions or the subcontinental scale. So I think it does highlight a potentially serious issue with models at the regional level over the North Atlantic region over Greenland, which, as I said, is linked at times with extreme weather conditions further south.
Well, right. Governments and corporations need scientific advice to help plan future spending and energy and development. They may not heed that advice, but they do need it. So if our models are still unable to grasp real changes in the climate, do we have other viable alternatives?
I don't think so. I think we need to keep trying to refine the models and also just to link together what the observations are showing with what the models are showing. So I think it's also the way science works is bringing different sub-communities of scientists together a bit more to discuss data sets and models, which is being done more than it used to be, but I think there could be even still a bit more of that. So basically, models are the way forward. We need to keep using them and finding areas where they work less well and then refining them.
The UK has been widely known as the rainy kingdom, but in the 2000s, as you mentioned, there have been some sunny heat waves and even drought in parts of the country. Surprising stuff. Does your research warn North Europeans of wetter weather to come, or do you just say it's possible?
Well, I think it's a distinct possibility. We cannot say for sure, of course. We're not in the directly doing seasonal prediction here, although we're working on that separately. I mean, certainly the UK is known as a nation of huge variations in weather. I mean, it's obviously quite world famous for that. But I'd just like to point out that although we have had these record, 2003, obviously, record heat wave over Europe, also 2006, somewhat lesser heat wave, and this year, 2018, we've also had these two record wet summers as well, 2007 and 2012, that you mentioned earlier. So there's been huge variation at both ends of the spectrum, near record years in the context of the last century or so. And while we get variation, it's really interesting to and important to understand some of these processes, such as over Greenland, because they can potentially increase that variation and give us even more extremes. And all the time, remember, there's an undercurrent of increasing average temperature, so it can make the warm years when we get them obviously much more exceptional statistically. But also with these changes over Greenland that I've mentioned, there's also the distinct likelihood that we might get more of these record wet summers as well.
As an aside, I recently read in the Atlantic magazine an article about a period around 230 million years ago called the Carnian Pluvial Episode. And essentially, as I understand it, when the climate warmed between 5 and 7 degrees C, it rained over the Earth for about a million years. And we're starting out possibly to warm that much, maybe not this century, but in the next couple of centuries. Nobody's predicting that as an outcome of our current warming. But does your research, doesn't it kind of say we can't be sure what is going to really happen with this planetary experiment? Your thoughts, Edward?
Well, I mean, the interesting point is the we're doing an experiment to the planet that's not exactly the same as what's happened in the past, according to our best understanding. So we're kind of a bit in uncharted territory. So I totally agree that it's very useful to have a look at some of these past climate episodes, even though we probably don't understand that much about some of them, especially these ones that happened so many, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago. But we're doing an experiment where we're very rapidly increasing greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere, and that is likely to have some consequences in terms of extreme weather events that we don't yet properly understand, because, as I say, the models are not always perfectly working at the regional scale, and yet there's regions such as the UK, but many other regions that are very highly sensitive to even tiny shifts in the jet stream, give you completely opposite conditions in the summer. So, I mean, I really think we're kind of in uncharted territory. And also to note that the 5 to 7 degrees that you mentioned, well, there are model projections that have the Arctic warming more than that in the rest of this century. So you are causing some destabilizations potentially in surface climate over large regions, resulting from very rapid changes in the short periods of time. So I think it's quite interesting in looking at the effects on rainfall and hydrological regimes, as well as just temperature. And of course, we've already discussed some of those recent extremes, which could possibly be enhanced going in over the next few decades.
By the time a paper's published, scientists are often away on another quest. Edward, from your perspective, what are some of the big questions to be answered?
I'm interested in a number of these areas. Obviously, there's not that many people living over Greenland, in Greenland, compared with in mid-latitudes further south. But in terms of impacts of climate change on in Greenland, it's very important to those people who live there locally. But there's hundreds of millions of people living further south over mid-latitudes, such as the UK and parts of the US and Russia and Japan and so on. So I think it's really important to understand the links between Arctic, very rapid recent changes in ice and climate in the Arctic, and these changes in the jet stream further south, more generally, not just looking at Greenland, but also the contribution to sea level from changes in the Greenland ice sheets and Antarctic ice sheets, which are really kind of two sleeping giants. And I mean, there's a whole lot more material, obviously, we could talk about that. But I mean, certainly from my perspective, I'm interested in a whole range of questions that link to these two main themes. And there's certainly a lot still to understand there.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us about?
Basically, I'm really interested in, with my team and other collaborators and so on, looking at the links between climate change generally and extreme weather events across a range of timescales. Because as I said before, climate change is linked with the local weather conditions that people experience. But traditionally, some of the way that we've analysed the climate data, we've compartmentalised timescales, so we've not always linked across what people are actually experiencing on the ground. I think doing more of that is really important. And also, what happens in the Arctic, as you mentioned Jennifer Francis earlier, I think she's been quoted as saying, it doesn't always stay in the Arctic, can affect latitudes further south. So I really do think that there's a whole lot that we can look at in terms of deciphering some of these key issues. Lots to keep us busy anyway.
It's odd that the greatest warming is happening in a place where hardly any humans live, and so we don't really report about it, and that is the Arctic.
Absolutely, yes. And yet it's a critically important region in terms of both weather patterns further south, quite likely, I believe, but also obviously directly in terms of sea level rise from response to the ice sheets. And as you've also mentioned, changes in the sea ice as well. I mean, if you're removing all that sea ice, as has happened from the Arctic in the last few decades or so, you're fundamentally changing the amount of energy, increasing the amount of energy absorbed by the oceans. So there's lots of what we call feedback effects that are enhancing rapid warming over the Arctic, which is obviously quite scary on the one hand, but it's also really interesting to study and try and understand on the other.
From Lincoln, UK, we've been talking with Dr. Edward Hanna. He is Professor of Climate Science and Meteorology at the University of Lincoln. We've been talking about a paper titled Brief Communication, Recent Changes in Summer Greenland Blocking Captured by None of the CMIP5 Models. That was published October 16, 2018, by the Cryosphere, and that's a journal from the European Geosciences Union. The critical research comes from Hannah and Dr. Richard Hall at Lincoln, with help from the University of Liège. This paper is free to the public, and you can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Edward Hanna, thank you so much for joining us again here on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Famous American scientist Michael Mann is coming up, plus interviews with lead scientists on alarming news. There is way more heat in the ocean than anyone thought possible. Along the way, we discover why all the computing power behind Bitcoin can, all by itself, take us to the 2-degree danger zone. When scientists are on edge, they talk directly and fully to you on Radio EcoShock. For links to follow up on this program, check out my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
This is the Taylor Report, CIAT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conlon.
Good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to talk about, among other things, Phil, you're going to, about 15 minutes, we're going to talk to you about the labor movement. At the top, we're going to talk to Otis Richmond, who spoke the other night at a different book list, 779 Bathurst, about the great Walter Rodney, who was assassinated, I think the year was 1980. And he was an outstanding scholar and activist from Guyana. And I'm very glad they had that forum. We're going to talk to Otis about it. And at the halfway point, we will talk to Zafar Bengash, Crescent International, about the whale of a crisis around the government of Saudi Arabia and the man named Khashoggi. I suspect Zafar Bengash, who has written a lot about the, and predicted the downfall, he said, of the title of his book is The Doomed Kingdom. So he's going to be really happy to talk to us about this. But we're joined now by Norman Otis Richmond. Are you there, Norman?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Very good. We're glad to be talking to you. Last week you were a part of a forum panel at a different book list, 779 Bathurst, and it sounds like a very exciting event. I'm sorry that I was not able to attend it. Let's start with your contribution. Tell us why, well, first of all, they were having this event in the name of Walter Rodney, and then what your thoughts were.
Well, this event was to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the banning of Walter Anthony Rodney from coming back to Jamaica. Walter Rodney was one of the speakers at the Black Writers Congress in Montreal, Canada. It was a very successful conference, and everyone from Kwame Ture to many people were there. And Walter came there from Jamaica, and they would not let him come back to Jamaica.
Wow. And why? What, did they state why they weren't allowing him?
They thought he was a subversive. First of all, go back to 1968. The conservative party was in power at that time. Mm-hmm. Edward Seaga's party was in power, and they were basically anti anything progressive, especially socialism, Marxism, Leninism, and so on and so forth. So Walter was able to come to Jamaica and make a impact on. He taught in the universities, but he spent a lot of time in the trenches of the society. And he wrote a book called "Groundings with My Brothers," and there were a few sisters there. But he would go into the deprived areas. Mm-hmm. As I guess as Elvis would say, who go into the ghetto. And
a word, by the way, that seems to have disappeared from the language.
Mm-hmm.
Who decided to get rid of that?
That's a good question. But Walter went into the community, the oppressed community, and taught class, you know, basically talked. Mm-hmm. He taught classes, and he would listen to people, and he was very, very popular, so they did not want him. Basically, mm-hmm. they just used that as an excuse to get rid of Dr. Walter Rodney. And I know a lot of people. Like, there was one speaker at the event named Alyssa Trott, and she's the head of the Caribbean Studies Department. She's also Guyanese and many years younger than Walter, but she knew Walter as a kid. And I met her many years ago, about 30 years ago, as a matter of fact. And one of the things that always amazed me was she never referred to Walter Rodney as Dr. Walter Rodney. She always referred to him as Wally. And all of the people that I knew, I never heard the Dr. Walter Rodney. All I heard was Wally. He was, he didn't.
Didn't put on airs, I guess.
He didn't put on airs. He wasn't into, I'm doctor and I went to school and I made the sacrifice, so you mm-hmm. honor me by calling me doctor. Yeah. You know, he just called him Wally, you know.
Well, he was quite a successful man in politics. Unlike most scholars who try to be activists, he was pretty good at it, wasn't he?
Yeah, he lived on five continents, and I met him I met him two times. I met him one time. I met him in Toronto, Canada. He came into the Contrast office, and then I met him. I was slipping, as they say, I was slipping into darkness. I was underground, and I came to his house in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But the first time I met him, he came to, he walked into Contrast. He was with Horace Campbell, mm-hmm. Dr. Horace Campbell, and he and Dr. Horace Campbell were arguing or debating about Roberta Flack.
About Roberta Flack?
Yeah, and
well, now we're getting down to it.
And Walter Rodney was yay. He was saying Roberta Flack was the greatest thing since sliced bread, not just because she was a great singer, but because she had done many, many things. I think when Bob Marley was shot, when Bob Marley was shot, at one time, as most people will know if they do some history, Bob Marley was shot, and he had to go underground in Jamaica first. And he did the Pete One Love concert. But during that time, Roberta Flack flew to Jamaica to basically be at the concert, but they actually took her to where they were hiding Bob Marley before he never left the country until after he did the concert, the One Love concert. And Roberta Flack was taken to uh-huh. him, uh-huh. and while he was, you know, under distress. And I think she has, when Bob passed away, when he was sick in Florida, put it this way, she and Bob had a very positive relationship. They knew mm-hmm. one another, uh-huh. and, you know, Roberta was...
So to Walter Rodney, this was proof of a solid person. This is the evidence of her great quality.
Yes, and the other guy, Horace, for some reason, was not impressed with Roberta Flack. And then the second time I saw Walter, like I say, I was slipping into darkness, as the war said, and mm-hmm. I was with some more people who were also under the radar, and mm-hmm. we came to his house in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I can remember his son, his oldest son, was named Shaka. Mm-hmm. And I think Shaka is living in Barbados now, but he was running around the house in diapers. And
mm-hmm. and now he's a doctor.
I don't know if he's a doctor, but I know he lives in Barbados, and he's doing quite well. Walter had three children, two daughters and Shaka. Mm-hmm. And academically, his wife, Patricia Rodney, I think she's in Atlanta, but they're all did quite well academically and
Well, now he's Guyanese. Has the family, are they not any longer based in Guyana? Have his children living outside the country?
I don't think anybody in his family lives in Guyana. UC Guyana, or it used to be called Sidney King, He was in San Diego for many years. I met him.
Is it considered still dangerous for them, you think?
The government changes from time to time, but I don't know. UC Quiana, who used to be named Sidney King, he was with Chetty Jagan and Forbes Burnham in 1953 when the country was independent, and he was forced out of the country. And he, first of all, he had to move to San Diego, and his wife was an African born in the United States, born in America, and she passed away. And then I think UC right now is living in Atlanta with his sons.
Mm-hmm. This panel and your role in it, did you take up different aspects of his writing? I mean, he was a great scholar. He produced really some important theoretical work.
Alyssa Trotz, being Guyanese and known Walter Rodney, as a child, she basically delivered, the keynote speech, and she basically talked about, what type of scholar activist he was, and the fact that he taught on five continents. And he came back to Guyana in, 74. And, he lived, I met him in Ann Arbor. He was teaching that in Ann Arbor. And he also taught in Dar es Salaam, and he taught in Jamaica. And he came back to the Caribbean. He felt that he had to come back to the Caribbean.
He taught in Dar es Salaam.
He was in Dar es Salaam for many, many years. And he felt he had to go back to the Caribbean. So when he went back to the Caribbean, he went to the Caribbean. But the only time he left the Caribbean was when Robert Gabriel Mugabe and his party gained independence in Guyana. He was under the gun at that particular time. Burnham was gunning for him, but he sneaked out of the – is it snuck or snuck? Sneaked. I speak Ebonics. He got out of there. He got out of there, and he went to the independence celebration, and he was getting ready to go to trial in Guyana, and he snuck into the country, into Zimbabwe. Robert Gabriel Mugabe begged him to stay in Zimbabwe. Uh-huh. And write the history of Zimbabwe, and offered him a job and so on and so forth, and he refused. Came home, and 2 or 3 weeks later, he was assassinated.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
he would have been in the same position as Du Bois when Kwame Nkrumah invited Du Bois. It's really
in this case,
it really since he lost his life, I assume. Some mention was made of that wonderful book. Was it How Colonialism Underdeveloped Africa, or was it Imperialism?
How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. Yeah. Oh, I'll give you a joke. It's not really a joke, but I think that book has been published by Random House.
Yeah.
I guess Lenin that made the statement that, after a certain period of time, what did he say? That the capitalists will sell the rope that could hang themselves, they can make profit.
By the way, they do tend to. That's one of the things they do after famous people are done in. They sell bits of their hair and parts. It's a horrible fact in history. It does happen.
They're selling, I guess the Satan Revolution at one time was outselling the Bible. And I don't think the Communist Manifesto is despite the fact you can get it on the internet, I would think the Communist Manifesto. I wouldn't mind getting the residuals from.
If you follow the stock market as it goes up and down, that's when the the manifesto rises and falls. It seems to be haunting. There's a specter haunting this the stock market. If you could, in the last moments here, encapsulate. So, what did you tell? What was your main point on the night of this forum for Walter Rodney?
My main point was that Walter Rodney was a scholar activist who basically educated Africa and the world about you know, the importance of oppressed people, Africans in particular, and all oppressed people in general, to fight capitalism, imperialism, and to form a united front. And he was not into this anti-Indian thing. He was not a chauvinist. He was basically talking. Well, I guess I could say he was. He believed in the unity of the working class. Period. But he was also myself. Like myself, I guess he had a special place for the band-bound world in terms of you know, the people of color, especially in his earlier days. You know, like. He believed in the unification of the Africans, Indians, Chinese, and everybody coming up against the, you know, European imperialism, because European imperialism did a number on Africa, Asia, Latin America, and even their own working class.
Actually, my impression is they're still at it, but Norman Otis Richmond. We're glad you talked at the different book list, 779 Bathurst 8. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We got a little music. Apropos, a lovely singer is going to sing here.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Rothschild, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, who assesses the outcome of the 2018 midterm election and prospects for progressive movements challenging President Trump's extremist agenda. Sayu Bajwani, founder of the group New American Leaders, who talks about her book titled People Like Us, The New Wave of Candidates, Knocking at Democracy's Door, an examination of how immigrants are changing America's political landscape, and the voices of local Connecticut activists who mobilized to protect immigrant rights, countering President Trump's message of hate and fear in the closing days of the midterm election campaign. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
3 years ago, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko asked Facebook to stop Russia's use of it to promote fake news about the conflict in Ukraine. The PBS Frontline program reports that Ukraine was the proving ground for Russian attempts to employ social media strategies to influence domestic politics of rival nations. Similar tactics were used during the 2016 US presidential election and in other countries, including the Philippines and Myanmar. Former Facebook employees were aware of Russia's cyber warfare in the Ukraine, but top company executives ignored the warnings. Across the globe, Facebook had been viewed as a force for change and reform, including during the 2011 Arab Spring and the 2014 Maidan Revolution in the Ukraine, which deposed a regime with close ties to the Kremlin. Critics have accused Facebook of turning a blind eye to their platforms being used as a megaphone by Buddhist nationalist leaders in Myanmar who had called for the murder and expulsion of the Muslim Rohingya minority. In March, the United Nations declared that Facebook had a determining role in the genocide there. In reacting to the criticism, Facebook has moved to censor what it views as extremist content, including Alex Jones' InfoWars site in the US. But this precedent has also recently been used to remove credible, progressive news sites as well, prompting Rolling Stone magazine's Matt Taibbi to write, "The endgame here couldn't be clearer. This is how authoritarian marriages begin, and people should be very worried." Top prosecutors in South Florida, including Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle, are calling on the Florida Supreme Court to overturn an expanded version of the notorious Stand Your Ground gun law that has been used as a defense in high-profile murder cases. In court papers, the League of Prosecutors, a Miami group of current and former local state's attorneys, says that the revamped law forces prosecutors to try self-defense cases before a judge, not a jury. The Stand Your Ground gun law, first passed in 2005 with the strong backing of the National Rifle Association, was used successfully by defense attorneys in the murder of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin, who was shot and killed by gunman George Zimmerman. According to the Miami Herald, a newly expanded version of the Stand Your Ground law played a role in how the shooting death of Marques McLaughlin in Clearwater, Florida, was handled. The victim was shot in a dispute over a parking space. However, the local sheriff did not immediately arrest the shooter, Michael Drezka, citing the expanded Stand Your Ground law, although prosecutors later charged Drezka with manslaughter. For years, the burden of proof in self-defense cases fell on the defendant. Now, under the new Stand Your Ground law, the responsibility rests with prosecutors to disprove a defendant's claim of self-defense. Activists in New York and California converged last winter to expose and protest the housing abuses of financial giant Blackstone Group, run by billionaire Stephen Schwarzman, an ally of Donald Trump. Blackstone is worth over $400 billion. According to the American Prospect, companies owned by Blackstone employ over 450,000 people and manage nearly 300,000 residential housing units. Blackstone also owns mortgage and installment loan companies. Private equity investors operate by leveraging capital from pension funds and insurance companies in order to buy companies and then to extract profits, often by loading those companies with debt and by reducing wages and benefits for workers and other stakeholders. With its massive size, Blackstone has become a lightning rod for housing, community and labor activists regarding its exploitative housing and lending practices, its labor disputes, crony capitalism and environmental destruction. In Greater New York, Make the Road called on Blackstone to bar its affiliates, including Finance for America and Bayview Asset Management, from foreclosing on properties in hurricane-ravaged regions, including Puerto Rico, Florida, and Texas. Activists in New Jersey pressured the state pension fund to lean on Blackstone to halt foreclosures in Puerto Rico, which it did until a self-imposed moratorium on foreclosures expired in September. The extreme concentration of economic ownership and power in 21st century America is creating more opportunities for disparate groups to ally against common adversaries and to pressure them for broad concessions on issues of social justice. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
In what many commentators and political observers have declared the most important midterm election in recent U.S. history, Democrats won control of the House of Representatives and broke the Republican Party's monopoly on federal political power. The campaign, unlike any other in decades, was characterized by President Trump's naked appeal for support for his Republican Party based on white identity politics, the demonization and denigration of immigrants, Muslims, and people of color. While that appeal helped Trump win the presidency in 2016 through the Electoral College, he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by some 3 million ballots. In their victory on November 6, voters supporting Democratic candidates had to overcome GOP-engineered voter suppression tactics, massive voter purges, and partisan gerrymandering of congressional district maps. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine. Here he assesses how the outcome of the 2018 midterm election can change the direction of the nation, prospects for progressive movements challenging President Trump's extremist agenda, and concerns about the next 2 years under a Trump presidency.
The Democrats can act as a check against any reactionary laws that Trump is trying to pass. So that's essentially the House would have veto power. And equally important, the Democrats in the House can have their own investigations. They can have subpoena power. They can start impeachment hearings, which they ought to. They have an obligation to because of the terrible violations of the Constitution and of our very democracy that Trump is committing. And so that's what they should do. They should start hearings right away, send out, you know, hundreds of subpoenas and use the power that they have. I fear that some of the moderate leadership in the party is going to be squeamish and say, well, we got to play to the middle here. We don't want to seem like obstructionists or whatever. They have an obligation, if they win, to pursue these Trump scandals and to start impeachment hearings pronto. So I hope they do that.
Matthew, what can you say about some of the new crop of candidates we've seen emerge? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is kind of the poster child for this year's progressive candidates with different backgrounds than the usual suspects who step up, who run for office, who have deep pockets and a lot of links to wealthy folks. Do you find some hope in some of the new candidates that have stepped up, including a record number of women who for the first time are running for office?
Yes, young people, women, people of color, LGBT folks. It's very exciting to see this new generation and new stripe of leader among the Democrats. And that does indeed give me hope. And also the fact that, you know, we have openly socialists running. I mean, Bernie Sanders has inspired so many people to, you know, use the S word and say that they're socialists. And that's comforting, too. So I think, you know, the demographics are with the progressive movement in this country if we can get through this Trump era and still have a democracy to call our own. That's the real cutting question right now.
What's your assessment of progressive movements that have emerged since the Trump inauguration in 2017, the resistance movements?
You know, this is the most hope because the resistance to Trump started on day one or day two, if you want, with the Women's March, and it's continued all the way through with the great rallies for immigration rights, for immigrant rights, the rallies against climate change, the scientists marching, the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter movement. There is a lot going on at the grassroots. People are stirring in ways that they haven't stirred before. They're stirring on campuses, too. So civil society is standing up. That's the good news. It's standing up with the people, and it's actually standing up with some of the media, which is good. And our institutions are standing up, by and large, except for the Republican Party, which is collapsing on its knees in front of Donald Trump, which is a disgusting sight to see.
What are the major threats you see from the Trump White House over the next couple of years?
Well, let me go to the direst one. And the direst one is that he declares martial law. And that, don't think I'm just being hyperbolic here. It's possible if the United States is ever attacked again, not even at the scale of 9/11, maybe one-tenth of 9/11, that he could declare martial law. Or he could, if he decides to fire Mueller and pardon all his friends, then there would be a lot of protests in the street, I hope. But also then the Trump supporters and the white supremacists might incite some violence. And if there's a lot of violence in the street, Trump again could declare martial law. And who's going to stop him? You know, the old comment that Stalin made when he was told that the Pope didn't like the way he was treating Catholics. He said, how many divisions does the Pope have? Well, how many divisions does the House of Representatives have, or the Senate have, or the U.S. Supreme Court have? Trump's got a lot of divisions.
That was Matthew Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine. For more analysis and commentary on the outcome of the 2018 midterm election, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an era when the Republican Party has resorted to a brazen election campaign message, scapegoating immigrants and people of color
For America's economic problems, crime, and uncertain future, there are hopeful signs that an increasing number of Americans of diverse ethnicities and heritage are stepping up to run for public office. Although elected officials in local, state, and federal office remain overwhelmingly white, there's a growing consciousness among America's minority communities that in order to have a seat at the table and a voice in making critical decisions that affect their lives, they can choose to engage as political activists and candidates in the electoral system. The 2018 midterm elections are likely to be historic for a number of reasons, including the record number of women, immigrant, and first-generation candidates who've chosen to run for office. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stunned both political parties when she won her Democratic primary against 10-term incumbent Joe Crowley in New York's 14th congressional district. Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota could both become the nation's first Muslim women to be elected to Congress. Your reporter spoke with Sayu Bajwani, founder and president of New American Leaders, the only national organization focused on preparing immigrant and first-generation citizens to run for public office. Here she talks about her new book titled People Like Us, The New Wave of Candidates Knocking at Democracy's Door, an examination of how immigrants are changing America's political landscape.
Yeah, we have about 50 people that New American Leaders has trained over the last couple of years on the ballot in places like Arizona and Michigan and New York, California. And that momentum that has led to those 50 is not just our work, but of course this political moment. What New American Leaders does is recruit and train immigrant leaders to learn how to run for political office and to encourage them to run as they are with their stories front and center, using their stories and their commitment to their communities to expand the electorate by inviting new and what we call low-efficacy voters who often get ignored by traditional candidates and, frankly, by the political parties, inviting them to participate in the campaign. And so, you know, as much as, you know, one aspect of our work is about training people to run for office, the underlying goal is to expand the Democracy Party so that more people feel like they can be part of it.
So could you run through some of the institutional obstacles that stand in the way of people from diverse backgrounds, whether it be race or ethnicity or language? What are some of the things that are real difficulties that need to be overcome for these folks to come forward and run for office?
Some of the barriers are societal, if you will, or part of the system. And one of those, of course, that we hear often about is incumbent advantage, that it's very hard to challenge someone who's been in office for a long time and to really help run a competitive campaign against them. You need to get the support of other party leaders or endorsing institutions, and those folks tend to want to stick with the devil they know, right? So even if the incumbent's not all that good, there's a tendency to keep endorsing him or her at the expense of a newcomer. And of course, we want a democracy where there are more open elections and more people challenging incumbents, but that's really hard for newcomers to do. Another, I think, big challenge that newcomers face is the issue of money, and I'm sure that your listeners hear that quite a bit about the cost of a campaign. But also our system has not really been set up to work for modern America. So we had a time when founding fathers could decide that government worked well enough if a few people went to the state capitol for a certain period of the year and made the laws. But in today's America, you know, we want our legislators to be representing us year-round. We want them to be fighting for us year-round. But the salaries that we pay state legislators are anywhere from $17,000 to $24,000 for jobs that are considered part-time. And how that becomes an issue is that if I am someone who's trying to raise a family, pay off student debt, I really can't afford to be a legislator. So even if I could run a great campaign, it's hard for me to sustain my family and engage in public service in a meaningful way if I can't pay my bills. And so that incumbent advantage and the salary structure in state legislatures in particular are a couple of the obstacles that people face.
Sayu, what can you say about some of the newer candidates that have emerged since you wrote the book? Certainly one of the most prominent candidates from New York City, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who defeated a very powerful Democrat, Joe Crowley, in New York City, who was, I think, third in line for the House speakership among Democrats. But there are many others that we don't hear a lot about. What's your general sense of how many people have stepped up and run this year and are unexpectedly running very strong candidacies?
We tracked, our organization tracked, the number of foreign-born candidates, and there were nearly 200 in the primaries, and about 100 of them are headed into the general, and that's at all levels, you know, from Congress to school board. I would be spoiled for choice if I was writing the book now. There's so many more people. But as it relates to Alexandria and others, you know, even Ilhan's congressional race or Rashida's congressional race in Michigan, I think what we're seeing is a very specific set of strategies. One is to, you know, candidates who are running authentically, running by telling their story and owning who they are, whatever that might be, not trying to fit some sort of traditional candidate mold. The second is talking to voters, and especially the types of voters that tend to get ignored, people who are newly registered citizens, people who are not registered, people who are not used to going to vote in every single election. I think those two things are really, really important. And we've seen that in Alexandria's campaign. It's at the core of what we teach at New American Leaders. You know, I say this in my book, that we have this political quandary that we're in because the parties are churning out the usual type of candidates, and voters are saying, we don't want the usual type of candidate. We want someone who we can trust to fight for us. And I think that's what we've seen work over and over again this election cycle. We all are in this together, whether we like it or not. And it will, I think, work much better if we all accept that we have a shared goal for our country and for ourselves and our families.
That was Sayu Bajwani, author of the book People Like Us, The New Wave of Candidates Knocking at Democracy's Door. Learn more about how immigrants are changing America's political landscape by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the midst of a bitter midterm election campaign, where President Trump and members of his Republican Party pulled out all the stops to demonize immigrants, individuals and groups across the U.S. organized local actions to counter the right-wing message of hate and fear. On October 21st, about 200 supporters of immigrants' rights joined a 78-year-old man on a two-mile walk around Hartford, Connecticut, to press for freedom for an Ecuadorian immigrant in sanctuary for almost a year, as well as immigrants' rights generally. Al Dornan began walking a daily two-mile loop from his house in a nearby town last January, despite severe back problems and pain. Then several groups joined forces with Dornan to bring out walkers from throughout Connecticut. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and brings us excerpts of speeches made during the action. We hear first from Jose Diaz, a young Mexican immigrant and dreamer, followed by Al Dornan's concluding remarks.
So my name is Jose Diaz, and as I was over there in the beginning, thinking of what I was going to say, getting cold, as all of you are, I actually thought about the moment when I was crossing the border and how I had to swim the river. And as soon as I went inside, my whole body went numb of how cold the water was. When I got to the other side, I found out that we didn't have any change of clothes, and I was going to have to continue to walk all night in wet clothes while it was cold. So I got my work permit for DACA. I just renewed it. So I got it. And I wanted to speak about this right here. Undocumented, unafraid, unapologetic. Because even though I have DACA, that doesn't mean that I'm safe. That doesn't mean that I have documents. That just means that I'm able to be here for only 2 years and work. Unafraid. I have been afraid every day. And you know what makes me unafraid? My friends, my family, the people I love, all of you here today, making me not feel alone. Unapologetic. I'm not perfect. No one is. But I don't have to give explanations of why I'm even here, because my family was looking after me. They wanted a better future for me. And if it wasn't for them, to be honest, I'd probably be back in Mexico, not having an education. I would probably have joined a gang, like some of the friends that I had there, and I actually talked to, and some are actually dead. So comparing what I'm going through right now and the uncertainty, I prefer this rather than that. But I know if I go back, I don't know what's going to happen. I just want to finish with this. I really thank all of you being here because you give me strength. You give other immigrants strength. You give undocumented community strength as well. And this isn't over. I really wish that all of you can get involved and actually make a difference, because together we can make anything happen. Thank you.
That was Jose Diaz, a young undocumented Mexican immigrant. Al Dornan finished the walk back where the group started, outside the Hartford Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and spoke to the group about his commitment.
The people who come to this country today are fleeing from dire poverty. They are fleeing from crime. They are fleeing from despotic governments, which in great measure were brought into power by the misguided foreign policy of our own government. The people today who are now walking through Mexico towards our border, where they will be denied entry into the United States, if necessary, with government troops. This is not right. This needs to change. Not only am I the son of immigrants, I am a dreamer. When I was a young boy growing up in America in the 1940s and the 1950s, I enjoyed the American dream. But I enjoyed the American dream only as a white male American. When I was growing up in this imperfect country, black people were to a great extent still treated as less than human. Women were still treated as baby makers and cooks in the kitchen. That cannot continue. This dream that I enjoyed must be for all people. All people in this world are entitled to the right to have equal opportunity to live a good and wonderful life. And I am saying to you today, please believe me, I am saying to you today that for me, this is only the beginning. I will walk until I am physically unable to walk. A week ago, on last Sunday, a man who I would suspect many of you as South and Central Americans know, Archbishop Oscar Romero, was canonized as a saint in the Catholic Church. But you and I know that he didn't have to be canonized. He was a saint a long time ago. And I am proud that I follow the guidance of Archbishop Oscar Romero. If he could give his life for the people he loved and cared about, then why can't I give my back and my feet dedication to the people I care about? I love you all. Thank you for coming. I will continue.
That was Al Dornan, a fierce 78-year-old supporter of immigrants' rights, preceded by Jose Diaz, a young undocumented Mexican immigrant. Learn more about local grassroots campaigns to protect immigrants' rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on eJazz Radio in Kampala, Uganda, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Kaddish, for the tree of life. Kaddish in Jewish ritual is sung at the graveside of the departed. It is a chant, a song, a psalm of life and loss, which now, in the quiet city of Pittsburgh, must be sung almost a dozen times after a white racist armed with an AK entered a synagogue, a Jewish temple, during a naming ceremony for children and left death in his wake. This massacre occurred just days or hours after another man left over a dozen bombs to be mailed to several former presidents, an actor, and several prominent black politicians. What connects these two events besides time? Both men left messages online showing hatred for immigrants, whom they called invaders. Where have we heard that word recently? At Trump rallies, the U.S. president sends his audiences into wild applause when he damns people of Latin America as invaders of North America. Yes, it must be said that Trump spoke out against anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish hatred recently. But I ask you, if you can, to listen again, you will hear silence. No applause, no yells or peals of agreement, just silence of the lambs. President Trump began his campaign by damning Mexicans and flashed from there to immigrants. And after his embrace of the white nationalists of Charlottesville, Virginia, who can be surprised at the flash fire of hatred for Jews? Trump has lit the flames of rhetoric with his tongue at rallies across the nation. How can we be surprised when those who hear him send bombs or open fire? From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Young man in prison who uses his time studying so that when he leaves, he'll have something to contribute to his family and his community. He studied cooking when he was in high school and went on to being certified in this culinary art. He's since studied business, electronics, and other areas to lift his levels of skill. He applied for a Pell Grant at the state prison in Mahanoy to take a college course in business. But guess what? Prison officials denied his application. Why? Because, they said, he knew enough. Therefore, he didn't need it. Unbelievable. When prisoners come to prison, one thing, and one thing only, stops them from returning to prison. Education. The more you know, the less you'll find yourself returning to the dead end of prison. And it isn't like the classrooms here are bursting at the seams. For out of 20 men who initially applied for Pell Grants and college courses, about 5 have continued in their studies. The rest, they've dropped out. Education really works against recidivism. Maybe that's why they really don't want Mike to go to college. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. On November the 6th, a political earthquake is coming. Reporters are almost breathless with tales of blue waves and transformation from one party to another. But if such predictions seem so sure, remember the elections of 2016, when polls proved woefully inadequate. Predictions fell like yesterday's lottery tickets. For polls, ultimately, are snapshots in time, and they can prove fallible to something as simple as the weather. Rain and cold temperatures can depress voting, as the hardiest dare to brave the winds or weather of fortune. We are witness to the politics of fear and hatred of the other, them, those who are not us. But who are we, if not them? It is interesting to see and hear of invaders to these shores. For to the indigenous First Nations, all who now inhabit America, with the possible exception of Africans, are invaders, the refuse of Europe. Here, they slaughtered millions of so-called Indians to make Lebensraum, German for living room, for so-called whites. Politics, that great machine of division, can call the people to fear and enmity, or it can call them to unity and common purpose. Time will tell which will prevail. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Was the Venezuelan president's use of a constituent assembly an opportunistic power grab? What is the true source of food shortages and economic hardship in present-day Venezuela? How is the Canadian government obstructing local solidarity actions? How does the Venezuelan government's crackdowns on dissent over the last year compare with the repression of the late 1980s? On this week's Global Research NewsHour radio show, we continue our coverage of the Venezuelan crisis with two guests. First, we hear from Telesur journalist Mike Preisner about the omissions in Western media's coverage of Venezuela. Then we hear from Barry Weisletter, a Canadian organizer with Socialist Action, about Canada's complicity in the Venezuelan crisis and about a frustrated effort to engage in a dialogue with a Venezuelan official last month. Finally, we will hear an excerpt from a talk delivered at a Winnipeg venue by Venezuelan Minister Carlos Ron Martinez on October 19th. On this week's program, Maduro in the crosshairs, what you are not being told about the Venezuelan crisis. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 9th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. While Canada chooses to speak of the dire human rights and humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, where there is none, it ignores, condones, and rather endorses Saudi Arabia in the making of one of the worst humanitarian crises in Yemen. That is the most vicious double standard that a democratic country can demonstrate. Many of the arguments in the response to the petition have been questioned and rejected in a long-standing rebuttal to the government's position on Venezuela in other venues. For instance, Canada continues condemning the National Constituent Assembly, or ANC, that it claims was, quote, established in contravention of the Venezuelan Constitution, unquote. That is a blatant lie. That comes from the article, Citizens' Petition to Lift All Sanctions Against Venezuela is Rejected by Canadian Parliament, by Nino Paglicia, posted November 9th. The Obama 2008 Coalition of Youth, Latinos, Blacks, and Union Labor dissolved as fast as it was formed. The result of that was not only the debacle of 2016, but the subsequent conservative conquest of the Supreme Court and virtually the entire federal judiciary under Trump, an across-the-board wipeout of decades of business regulations, a $4 trillion tax windfall for business, investors, and wealthy households, a total retreat on climate change, and a descent into a nasty political culture of emerging white nationalism and increasing secret violence and polarization. It all began with Obama's naive bipartisanship that we now see Democrat Party leaders like Pelosi and no doubt the corporate moneybags on the DNC attempting to resurrect once again. Bipartisanship is a political indicator of a party no longer convinced of its own ability to lead and forge a new direction. Contrast the results of the Democratic Party bipartisanship from Obama to Pelosi with Republican Party rejection of anything bipartisan. That comes from the article, None Dare Call It Victory, Analysis of U.S. 2018 Elections, Part 2, by Dr. Jack Rasmus, posted November 9th, originally appearing on the author's blog site, jackrasmus.com. Dr. Joel Moskowitz, a University of California, Berkeley public health professor, told the UK's Daily Mail on May 29th, 2018, that the deployment of 5G, quote, constitutes a massive experiment on the health of all species, unquote. In order to facilitate faster data transfer speeds, 5G will utilize millimeter waves, smaller waves accessed through a higher frequency of the electromagnetic spectrum not previously used by the telecom industry. These smaller waves cannot travel far, nor can they penetrate many types of materials. So this means that there will need to be millions of small cell towers about the size of a refrigerator close together within a few feet of one another on every street. Dr. Moskowitz warns that these millimeter waves can affect the eyes, the testes, the skin, the nervous system, and the sweat glands. That comes from the article 5G Corporate Grail, Microwave Radiation by Joyce Nelson, posted November 9th, originally published on Watershed Sentinel. While the reopening of an embassy might not ordinarily seem like much, the case of the UAE's plan to reportedly do just that in Damascus is actually much more important than the casual observer might think, particularly after the Syrian deep state-connected AMN revealed that this might be the opening stage of a much larger pivot to the GCC countries. While appearing at first glance to be against Iran's interests, the opposite might be true if one accepts that Tehran cannot continue indefinitely funding its military mission to the Arab Republic under the U.S. sanctions pressure and that its post-Daesh presence there is provoking Russia's Israeli ally to escalate the situation to the point of possibly reversing all the stabilizing gains that were made in the country over the past 3 years. The argument can be made that it's better for Syria to request Iran's phased withdrawal under the face-saving pretext of leaving as heroes than to bear the consequences of keeping its forces in the country after their original mission has been completed. Iran cannot afford the military and economic costs of fighting a lopsided proxy war with Israel in Syria, even if it serves the political purpose of temporarily distracting its population from the predicted worsening of their living conditions throughout the course of the U.S. reimposed sanctions regime. Nor does Damascus even want this conflict to take place on its territory, precisely at the point when so much has been achieved over the past few years and a so-called political solution is finally within sight. Syria isn't betraying Iran because the two already signed a military deal over the summer and will continue to cooperate in a normal capacity. But it's just that Damascus might have reached the conclusion that the reconstruction assistance that it could obtain from the GCC is worth downscaling that specific facet of its strategic partnership with the Islamic Republic if it was already proving to be troublesome as it is. That comes from the article, What is the Significance of the Reopening of the UAE Embassy in Damascus? Syria's Pivot Towards Reconciliation with Saudi Arabia? By Andrew Karibko, post November 8th, originally appearing at Eurasia Future. Once developed, the system, which was originally intended only for occasional low-level use, was then deployed to handle nearly all the CIA's agent communications worldwide, including a number of key countries targeted by Washington to include Iran and China. Each country had a separate site, and the sites themselves were set up under innocuous business or social cover arrangements, which presumably would have made them of no interest to prowling counterintelligence services. What exactly went wrong is not completely clear, but the mechanism was discovered by Iranian counterintelligence, possibly employing information provided by a double agent. The Iranians determined what kind of indicators and components the CIA site had and then went on a Google search to find other similar sites. They then watched their site as well as the others, noting both their activity and their idiosyncrasies, and presumably were able to penetrate the site directed against them. That comes from the article, The CIA's Latest Greatest Failure, by Philip Giraldi, posted November 8th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The UN Refugee Agency and the UN Migration Agency announced on November 8th that the number of migrants worldwide originating from Venezuela has reached 3 million. Internationally, the country has endured economic sanctions from the US, Canada, and other like-minded countries. In its public statements, The Canadian government has placed heavy emphasis on a report from a panel of independent international experts appointed by the Organization of American States Secretary General, which concluded that there are reasonable grounds to presume that crimes against humanity, as defined in Article 7 of the Rome Statute, may have been committed in Venezuela. Canada has also justified the imposition of economic sanctions on the Maduro government based on allegations that Maduro is undermining democracy in Venezuela and framed the Constituent Assembly as an unconstitutional and undemocratic power grab. Mainstream media's coverage of the situation in Venezuela has largely reinforced the narrative that blame for chaos in Venezuela falls squarely on the leadership. But is this a fair or accurate description of what's going on? Providing us with some background on the crisis in Venezuela is Mike Preisner. He's an Iraq War veteran and has worked in organizations of veterans and active duty U.S. military members to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He hosts the Eyes Left podcast, and he is co-producer with Abby Martin of the Empire Files for Telesur. He joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome, Mike Preisner, to the Global Research News Hour.
Michael, thanks for having me.
Now, there's been a lot of dialogue among Western governments and certainly in mainstream media about the undemocratic activities of the Maduro government, particularly the use of the Constituent Assembly as some sort of a power grab to thwart the democratically elected opponents in the National Assembly. Can you first off explain how that move has been democratically justified?
Sure. Well, I think in general, when it comes to the elections, elections in Venezuela are some of the most monitored and audited and checked in the entire world by countless international observation bodies, observers, things like that. And they always win the elections, right? I think out of the last 25 elections, the PSUV has won 21 or something like that. Really, the claim that the government is there undemocratically holds no water if you actually look at, the election system and who comes out to vote. But in just talking about the Constituent Assembly, in particular, the last election, Maduro won, clearly won re-election. The opposition had no candidate they could offer up that could perform in any way in the elections. And so if there was election fraud, it was the most massive election fraud of any country. Maduro won by several million votes. When it just comes to the Constituent Assembly, of course, the opposition used this as, this power grab. It was stacked with Maduro's family and Maduro loyalists, and it just overrode the legislative body, and it was just this new Maduro, pro-Maduro-only body that was, just stacked and created out of nowhere. First of all, the Constituent Assembly was afforded for in the Constitution. It was written into the Constitution that a body like this could be created. But the entire concept of the Constituent Assembly being undemocratic, the whole point of it was to resolve the problems in the country through democratic means. I mean, this was announced at a time when the opposition was essentially burning the country down, assassinating Chavistas, killing large numbers of people. And so what the PSUV did was say, if you want to work out our problems in our country, let's do it together, run and for this new body called the Constituent Assembly. And the PSUV begged essentially the opposition to run candidates for the Constituent Assembly to be part of it because it was a body that was going to make changes in the country. In fact, they extended the deadline for registering as candidates to try to get, because no opposition candidate had registered to run in the Constituent Assembly, they kept extending the deadline to try to get opposition candidates to run in it. So it was an attempt by the leaders of the country to say we should all sit down at the same table and work things out democratically versus fighting in the streets. But the reason that it was overwhelmingly won by Maduro supporters is because they're the only ones who ran, much like in the election. They're the only ones who ran because the same reason that Maduro won by a landslide in the presidential election is that the opposition, while they claim to be quite popular and they claim that Maduro is so unpopular that we shouldn't even wait for elections, but international forces should just come and overthrow him and install the opposition because they're really the popular ones. They are incapable of coming close to winning in any election. And so that's why they boycotted the Constituent Assembly, and that's actually why they boycotted the presidential election, except one opposition candidate to the anger of the U.S. and all the rest of the opposition decided to run. Their whole strategy was make them run unopposed, then we can call it a dictatorship because no one ran against them.
This is basically a public relations game from the point of the opposition.
It is, and that's because they've shown that they can't win power democratically. They've tried very hard and with the huge huge support from the United States. They've tried to win democratically. They can't. They've tried to win through coup and internal revolution by themselves, which they failed at in 2002 and in 2014. And so that they know that the only way they can take power, if they failed democratically, if they failed with the coup, the only way they can take power is by foreign assistance, as if the U.S. empire and other, you know, imperialist powers or junior imperialists in the region actually just come in and overthrow the government and put the opposition in. So they know that that's their only bet of taking power. And so from the violent street demonstrations to the boycott of the election, it's all with the consciousness that it's to create a picture to the public, to the international community, to then get more sanctions and more action. So that's even the, you know, when I was there, even the protesters we talked to on the ground, they're very much, they just want to be filmed by international press so then they could show it the international media to create an international scandal. So they're quite aware of what the strategy is, and they've been at it for some time.
Talk about those opposition protests. I mean, for people in Canada and the U.S., you know, following the media, they're reading the OAS-sponsored reports about violent government crackdowns on peaceful demonstrators. And can you speak to anything you witnessed on the ground that might shift that impression?
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, there's just the death toll numbers, right? I mean, so I was there in, you know, our summer of last year in 2017, which was at the height of the protest in August and September. And I mean, the very first thing is the death count, right? I mean, you know, Maduro has killed 100 protesters, and, you know, the general of the National Guard, he is responsible for the death of 100 people. So when we were there, we actually looked through, did really diligent research to classify each one of the deaths, you know, autopsy reports from legal leaders who are actually in the opposition and you know, classifying each of the deaths. And it actually turned out, when you look at them, that the vast majority, something like 80% or more, were deaths that were caused by the opposition, meaning lynchings, assassination, bombing and shootings of police, you know, targeting of Chavistas and killing them. And so, and you know, and just killing random people, like shooting into crowds with these homemade guns and things like that. And so many of the protesters that were killed by opposition protesters that were just standing behind them with these homemade shotguns. So at the very first look, you know, of course there were people killed by police and military, but that number was actually incredibly small compared to the number of killings that the opposition was carrying out. And the opposition was carrying out very gruesome killings. I mean, we're talking about they burned a man alive for being black and for being a Chavista, yelling, "Hey, get the black guy, we'll see what we do to Chavistas." And an entire mob of hundreds of people beat, stabbed, and burned him to death. And so those were the kinds of violent scenes that people weren't seeing in the United States and in the West. But that was very much the reality. So in my personal experience, though, with the opposition protests, I mean, of course, there are people in Venezuela that have very legitimate grievances against the government. It is in an economic crisis. Of course, you're going to have a sector of the population that is experiencing some discontent. And so there were peaceful demonstrations that were, when I went to the big peaceful opposition demonstrations, there was no government forces around. There was no police, there was no military. People were free to march and do whatever we wanted. But then there's the other types of protests, like guarimbas, which are much smaller in number and are extremely violent. And the night that I went out with the guarimba protests, I mean, it was about 300 young people wearing masks, marching around the streets, but not just marching, they were just attacking and burning everything, right? Going onto the highway, throwing Molotov cocktails at cars, blocking the freeway, pulling truck drivers out of their trucks and using 18-wheelers to block the freeway, setting things on fire. Of course, they burn. The things that they target are like city buses, maternity clinics, food storage warehouses, anything that's a sign of the government, they attack to burn down. And so the only time at this demonstration I was at that the government used any force is when the opposition, after they had taken over the freeway and everything, they marched to a military base and started throwing bombs at the soldiers guarding the base. And then so they fired a couple tear gas canisters, and then everyone ran away and said, "Please film us, we're being attacked." And so that was the extent of the clashes that I witnessed. But as I said before, it was all this kind of theater, right? It was to push as far as you can go to do as much violence and as much damage as possible until inevitably the police or military will respond and then throw the images around the world and say, "See how horribly we're repressed in this dictatorship." I will say that night, not a single person was arrested in the opposition protest, despite the chaos that they created. Now, I live in the United States, the supposedly the greatest democracy on earth, the one that's lecturing Venezuela. I've been arrested about 5 times for free speech, constitutionally protected free speech activity and protests here in the United States. Yeah, when I was in Venezuela, I saw not a single person arrested for quite serious crimes.
Now, is there any doubt in your mind that the media is deliberately sanitizing the situation? I mean, if they were doing their jobs, there would be we'd be seeing a different coverage?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, there's just in general the coverage of the crisis, right? I mean, all the news stories are, you know, people are butchering and eating dogs because there's no food, and then there's so much video footage of just grocery stores that are completely empty, nothing on the shelves, like it was a hurricane disaster or something like that. And then there's all these stories about how all of the media is controlled by the government and there's no free press in Venezuela at all. Well, when we were there, I mean, I went to quite a few grocery stores, quite a few food markets all over the country, and I did not see a single empty shelf. When you look at the newsstands and the news on the television, you see that the vast majority, like 90% of the media that you see, is very strong anti-government media. In fact, one of the newspaper headlines I saw when I was there was Trump must take care of Maduro, meaning Trump must come overthrow Maduro. That was like the most popular newspaper on the newsstand, or the most prominent one that you would see. I don't know if it was the most popular with the people. So there's little things like that where obviously the U.S. media is obviously creating a false picture because the alternative reality is so apparent. But then, you know, there's just so much more that's left out. I mean, and there's it's such a deliberate plan. But the other thing, other than just showing, you know, the economic reality, distorting it, but the protesters were just so glorified. I mean, even on so-called liberal shows like John Oliver's show on Comedy Central and or on HBO, and Vice and things that are considered these like kind of liberal outlets, they're portraying the opposition protesters as just like these heroic. It was like the Occupy movement in the United States, but in Venezuela, and there was heroic people fighting the worst kind of government repression. And it was completely whitewashing what was happening, that they were lynching black people, that they were burning people alive, that they were targeting press, targeting and killing journalists. I mean, so the reality was quite scary. We actually had to flee the country because when they found out who we were, myself and Abby Martin, we started getting a litany of death threats, and then it became unsafe for us to be there. And so to see the kind of, you know, the intense glorification in particular of these protesters as mostly peaceful victims, that was so far wrong, because they were actually brutally killing a large number of people and almost killed us as well.
Okay, I want to back up to something I heard you say earlier, that there aren't any grocery the shelves are not empty in mm-hmm. the stores. But to be fair, there are shortages of basic supplies, aren't there? Like cooking
Absolutely.
Oil, butter, flour,
Absolutely.
Toilet paper. I mean, could you fill in the public's the blanks in the public's understanding of why those food items are in short supply in this oil-rich country?
Sure. So all of the main food items, like the essentials in the pantry, as you said, cooking oil, flour, butter, things like that, they are produced by huge corporations in the country. I mean, Venezuela has elected a socialist government, but it's not a socialist country. They didn't seize the means of production. They didn't nationalize all of the corporations. So you still have these massive corporations in the country that still are in charge of the production of all of these things. And guess what? They're all people that are strongly anti-socialist, anti-Maduro, and were very strong anti-Chavez. And in fact, they are actually people that participated in the coup attempts in 2002 and 2014 and in other thwarted coups. So they're very much upset. It's not just the people on the streets that are part of the opposition. It's the richest people in the country, these billionaires that are just like Donald Trump. There's one company called Polar, which produces like 10 of the 12 major foodstuffs in the country. And so because they have such power in terms of production, as I said before, the whole plan is to create an international scandal, right, by showing how terrible it is in Venezuela. So they, of course, are intentionally not producing certain things, or they produce certain things and then release them on the black market, or they produce things and then they ship them over into Colombia and sell them at an exorbitant rate there. And so it is something that is completely manufactured. And you notice it's with particular things. It's with things that elicit a kind of response. So, you know, toilet paper is one of the things that is very hard to find, right? You can find other paper products, napkins, paper towels. I mean, all the materials that are used to make toilet paper are used to make other things. But why can't you find toilet paper? Because the companies are producing them, but then they are releasing them on the black markets or not giving them to the stores. This is a very intentional thing to try to create problems in the country and to create, you know, this kind of media spectacle of, oh my God, there's no toilet paper. It's like, well, who produces all the toilet paper in the country? And so one of the things that the socialist movement there has been doing is trying to develop their own modes of production so that they don't have to rely on the big corporations, like to produce flour and oil and all those things on their own, which they are doing, and they're doing in an increasing degree. But, you know, you can't overstate, you know, how much power the major corporations have in terms of production.
Could you speak a little bit more about those private corporations in Venezuela and how they're contributing to the inflation and economic crisis?
Oh, there's so many ways. I mean, just as I was saying with the products, of hoarding of products and then releasing them onto the black market so that the price is greatly inflated. And so, you know, all of the things that they're in shortage of, they're not in shortage. They're in shortage on the official shelves. They're not in shortage on the black market. Any of the things that there's a shortage of, you can find them on the black market, but for like 100 times the price. And that's coming directly from the corporations. There's also things like cash extraction. I mean, corporations will get, you know, a large sum of money from the government to produce things, and then they'll just literally ship the cash out of the country and sell the cash, in a sense, in Colombia and things like that. And so, you know, it's a sabotage. It's an act of sabotage, and it's rightly characterized as an economic war. I mean, coupled with U.S. sanctions, the actions of these big corporations like that, it has a very strategic and specific purpose to shatter the economy, and it is doing just that. When you have all these just different fronts of assault on the economic level, it has a huge impact on the economy, and that's the main reason the economy is in the state it's in.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like the oil companies' lockouts in the early 2000s.
Absolutely, and I mean, people really, that was one of the first examples of dictatorship by Chavez that fired all these top oil executives at the oil company and oil ministers. Well, they had jammed up the oil products. They had literally shut down the country by shutting off the oil industry. And so, of course, they were going to be fired. That's not a very dictatorial move when you're saving the country from disaster. So it's been a long process, and you're right to point that out because this didn't just start recently. I mean, since Chavez was democratically elected in Venezuela, and since the people became the political force in Venezuela, where for the first time the poor and working masses all of a sudden had the power, and they themselves were in charge, not Chavez. The U.S. empire and its allies in the region and the OAS, and of course the very, very rich in Venezuela, started a policy of trying to implement regime change through any means, whether it's democratic, violent, or whatever. But they've largely failed in that project over the last 20 years.
Okay, and maybe we could just sort of finish off. We hear a lot about desperate Venezuelans fleeing the country, but are there any unique underreported programs in place, citizen-driven or otherwise, that are assisting Venezuelans through the food shortages and other challenges?
Oh, of course. I mean, there's a program called the CLAP program, which is a massive effort of small farmers and communes and collectives across the country that's growing all of the food that is in short supply and distributing them for free to all the most in need families. So there's a regular distribution of CLAP boxes, which have all of the different foodstuffs in them. And so there's that and so many other programs. I mean, they really are, the entire country is really tackling it head on. But I think that's what the number one thing I learned there was, is that the people are so empowered and the people are so engaged. And so, yes, you have people fleeing the country because it's a hard life in Venezuela, because they're experiencing an economic war. So there are things that are in shortage, and there are all types of problems that are endemic of an economic crisis. And so, of course, you're going to have a certain sector of the population that wants to leave. But that's just a small percentage of the population. And the majority of the population, from what I saw, were not just politically aware, but they were politically engaged and all engaged in solving the problems of the country. So you drive through Caracas, you'll see just mass meetings of 100 people just randomly on the side of the road. And what are they talking about? They're talking about the Constituent Assembly. They're talking about the economic reforms that the government was proposing to try to save the country. I mean, to see just such a high level of grassroots democracy and grassroots activity was really quite impressive. And so I went into it thinking Venezuela's about to collapse. There's a huge opposition movement. The Chavistas are very weak, and they're in a position of just barely holding on to power. But when I was there in Venezuela, all across the country, I saw that, well, no wonder the opposition hasn't won yet, because the Chavismo movement is so strong and so engaged that even despite all of the terrible things that they're dealing with, they're still in a very strong position of dominance and power, which was extremely encouraging for me to see. And that's what you don't see in the U.S. press or in the Western press. You see the opposition protests. You never saw the millions of people that were marching in support of the government. And you never saw the millions of people that were actively engaged in meetings and discussions and elections and all of the things that real democracy looks like.
Mike Preisner, it's been a treat having you on the show. Thanks for joining us, and please send Abby Martin our regards.
I definitely will. Thanks so much, Michael.
We've been joined by Mike Preisner, a journalist, Iraq war veteran, anti-war activist, and co-producer of The Empire Files for Telesur Media Network. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. In October, there were long-planned efforts on the part of Canadian solidarity activists to bring a Venezuelan Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs to Canada to engage in a dialogue with Canadians about what is really going on in Venezuela. Plans were afoot to bring Minister Carlos Ron Martinez to Canada near the end of October and visit at least three Canadian cities, but those plans were derailed by the inability to receive a visitor's visa in time. When the Global Research NewsHour reached out to the Venezuelan embassy, they indicated that the visa application had not been authorized in time for the minister's planned visit. There's no word yet on whether or not the visa will ever be approved, but it is still theoretically under consideration. Joining me now is Barry Weisletter. He is a retired teacher and union organizer and the Federal Secretary of Socialist Action, one of the groups organizing speaking events for the Venezuelan minister. Barry Weisletter, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you on the show.
Tell us a little bit more about the Venezuela solidarity work Socialist Action has been engaging in recent years.
We are one of a number of organizations in the Toronto Venezuela Solidarity Coalition. I'd say there are a dozen organizations or more involved. At least half of them are, you know, Latino organizations with roots in the different countries of Central and South America. So it's great to work with them. And what we're coming up against is, hostile treatment of Venezuela by by the government of Canada, despite its pretenses to be for, you know, fairness and openness, transparency everywhere. That's not what they're demonstrating. In fact, they have definitively refused the entry visa requested for the Foreign Affairs Deputy Minister, Carlos Ron Martinez, who you mentioned a moment ago. The consulate told me just a few days ago that the request for an entry visa has been turned down by Ottawa. So the tour that had been planned, which was going to start in Ottawa and then continue through Montreal, Toronto, Winnipeg, and Vancouver and Victoria, is now not just suspended or postponed, it's canceled, and I think that's a shame.
Okay. How far back were organizers set when you proved unsuccessful in bringing the minister to Canada?
There was a meeting with consular officials in Toronto. I can't speak for other cities. In early October, they reached out to us and they said, "Well, we'd like to have an encounter with the deputy minister. Can you organize a venue? It's not going to be a huge, massive public meeting, but a meeting for all of the solidarity groups that are involved in the Toronto Venezuela Solidarity Coalition. And we have a track record of doing work to facilitate fairness towards Venezuela. Venezuela doesn't have a very big army. Colombia has a huge one, plus U.S. military bases bristling with weapons of mass destruction. But Venezuela has borne the brunt of U.S. Diplomatic and trade sanctions. About a year ago, the Venezuelan ambassador was expelled from Canada, and two other embassy officials were removed. So the head of the consulate in Toronto had to go as chef de mission in Ottawa, where, you know, that's where he leads the embassy there. At the same time, the government of Canada and even opposition parties have rolled out the red carpet for, you know, right-wing leaders, promoters of terrorism in Venezuela against the elected and re-elected many times government to visit Canada and to spread their untruthful version of the situation in the country. The country is suffering problems, and I would submit that most of them are the result of the sharp decline in the price of oil and the refusal of the European Union, Canada, and the United States to permit trade and normal commercial relations with Venezuela. There's also a horrendous problem of hoarding inside the country. There's lots of fruit and vegetables on sale at intersections and markets, across Venezuela, but a number of goods, that have been noted in the media, are in short supply, and that's because of hoarding, and it's also because of the trade embargo. So we want the truth to be known, and that's why Canadians have an interest in hearing what Carlos Ron Martinez has to say.
Okay, I just need to clarify something, because I was actually in charge I was in touch with the Charge d'Affaires of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela yesterday, and what I heard was that they had not been officially refused, that it was still under consideration. So you said that you were in charge with the Venezuelan people earlier, or who was it that told you that there was officially refused?
The consul general in Toronto.
And of course,
you know, I don't speak Spanish very well, and English is not her first or even second or third language, so I might have misunderstood, but I think it was communicated pretty clearly that there was no hope of this tour, you know, as planned, getting underway, because there's no entry visa agreed. And you know, Ottawa's been dithering about it for over a month. So, you know, it smells like and looks like and sounds like a political decision.
Okay. All right. Well, in that case, let me ask you if you can comment on maybe some of the other obstacles faced by organizers like yourself in raising awareness about Canada's complicity in the Venezuelan crisis and about actions that Canadians can perform to help.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the problems is just getting out the truth about what the situation in Venezuela. I've organized some public meetings with eyewitnesses come back to show videos and give accounts of what they've seen. But you don't see any fair treatment of Venezuela. I almost omitted the word fair. There's hardly any coverage of Venezuela because Canadian news organizations don't have reporters in the country. They rely on the news feed from U.S. media, particularly, you know, conservative media sources. And as a result, about a year and a half ago, we organized and we held a protest in front of the CBC headquarters in Toronto on Front Street to ask, you know, why there's no reporter in Venezuela, why we have one-sided reports and biased commentaries passed along through the Canadian media, including the CBC, which is the public broadcaster, you know, deriving their sources from U.S. media outlets, and we wanted to, you know, see the truth about the causes of the conflict in Venezuela. It's not just a political opposition. It's a very provocative, incendiary, terrorist-like opposition which has tried to overthrow the government of Venezuela through paralyzing street traffic, terrorizing people. In fact, there was an attempt to assassinate Maduro. President Maduro, just a few months ago in midsummer, was in downtown Caracas on a major boulevard, you know, reviewing a military parade, and these devices, you know, flying overhead. What do you call them? Drones, yeah, that's the word, exploded in midair, and more than one of them. And you'd expect, you know, when there's an assassination attempt on any leader of the EU or the United States or Japan or any, you know, any partner of the Canadian government, there would be some expression of outrage. But Chrystia Freeland had nothing to say about it. Justin Trudeau didn't deplore the attempt. In fact, they tried to they implied that to the extent that they said anything or that the media said anything here is that the Venezuelans had staged it in order to, you know, win sympathy, which is an absurdity. You know, the Canadian government is approving the sale of military vehicles to Saudi Arabia, which are deployed against the people of Saudi Arabia and quite possibly in neighboring Yemen as well, which is where there's a hot civil war underway and severe human humanitarian crisis in that country. So occasionally they tweak the position of the Saudi government, and they come down, you know, with resounding criticism against the government of Venezuela, which has, you know, not involved in any foreign wars, not engaged in the kind of repression that is normal in the Saudi Arabia and other countries with which Canada does business.
Barry, could I ask you then, you mentioned, you know, following on your points about the media, I recall there was a CBC report on September 11th, and it painted that, you know, sort of aligned its coverage with this whole meme about the Venezuela, the human rights abusers and democracy undermining and so on. And they did cite at least one Venezuela diaspora group, which was reinforcing that message. Okay. Uh-huh. So I'm wondering if you could share with us any conflict your group might have in your organizing with Venezuelans living in Canada who have been appearing in the media and reinforce that message that Maduro is a dictator and human rights violator.
We've had demonstrations, pickets and protests and rallies in front of the offices of Chrystia Freeland. Sometimes in years past, when there's an election in Venezuela or a referendum on the Constituent Assembly, which was adopted, we've met some opponents of the Venezuelan government, near the consulate in Canada, but there isn't regular contact with those folks. They don't come to public meetings that we've hosted on the subject. So rarely do we encounter them, but I'm sure they draw some of their motivation from the media coverage.
Okay.
I was in New York on September the 9th, and I opened the New York Times front page: U.S. met rebels from Venezuela about coup plot. And the writers in the opening paragraph say the Trump administration held secret meetings with rebellious military officers from Venezuela over the last year to discuss their plans to overthrow President Maduro, according to American officials, et cetera, et cetera. Hmm. That was not even reported in the Canadian press, that U.S. officials admitted to meeting with coup plotters from Venezuela. So there are other media sources, which I guess right-wing Venezuelans can obtain some of the information they do have from the Latin press in other countries. Keep in mind that Venezuela, most of the radio, television, and newspaper outlets in Venezuela are privately owned. So there's a daily barrage against the government. There are only two or three major networks that support the position of the government in Caracas. But we don't see the dissidents very, very often. But I'm not surprised that they're there, because they're getting all kinds of encouragement from Washington, Ottawa, and their allies and the establishment media.
Okay, so finally, could you comment on some of the activities that your organization plans to take on in coming months to assist the Venezuelan situation?
Well, we'd like people to communicate to their members of parliament, to the Canadian government, to write letters to the editor, to deplore Ottawa's refusal to, you know, grant an entry visa for Venezuela's Foreign Affairs Deputy Minister Carlos Ron Martinez. He should be able to enter the country and speak. What has Ottawa got to fear from what one official from Venezuela might say when there's, you know, such a chorus of hostility in the establishment media towards Venezuela? Venezuela is not perfect. It has problems. Not all of them are imposed from without, but it's up to the people of Venezuela to solve their problems. The Jimmy Carter Institute has stated repeatedly that elections and referenda that have been held in Venezuela are peaceful, above board, honest, and reliable and accurate. The Carter Institute doesn't say that about all elections everywhere that it observes. So I think that has some significance as well. We think people should protest Ottawa's position. We think Ottawa should get out of the Lima Group, which is a group of right-wing governments across Latin America, Caribbean, the United States, and Canada are involved, whose aim seems to be to isolate Caracas and you know, facilitate the overthrow of its democratically elected government. Ottawa, in the name of the Canadian people, should have nothing to do with these kind of disruptive, hostile actions against a peaceful democratic government. To the extent that Venezuela has to take measures against people who explode bombs, who try to set fire to the Supreme Court building, who try to assassinate the president, who stretch razor wire across roadways to catch motorcyclists, and kill them, as who set fire to supporters of the Venezuelan government, often because of their skin color, targeting dark-skinned Latinos in that country. These things show that there's a real conflict over for the future of Venezuela, and it's for the Venezuelans to decide. Without the sanctions and without the encouragement of the terroristic right wing that Ottawa, unfortunately, has been engaged in doing.
Barry, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with our listeners.
You're very welcome.
We've been speaking with Barry Weisletter, a retired teacher and union organizer and the Federal Secretary of Socialist Action. You can find out more about his organization by visiting socialistaction.ca. A postscript. Following this interview, the Global Research News Hour reached out to the Venezuelan Consul General for confirmation of the claim that Minister Karl Rahn's visa application was turned down. As of this show's first airing on Friday, November 9th, no such confirmation has been received. We did reach the charge d'affaires for the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. According to that source, in spite of what the Canadian organizers stated in the previous interview, the embassy is still waiting on an official response regarding the minister's visa application. The charge d'affaires also stressed that these sorts of delays are not uncommon in diplomatic circles for visa applications. In the remaining few minutes of our show, we will hear part of the speech delivered by the Venezuelan minister, Carlos Ron Martinez, to a Winnipeg audience by Skype call on Friday, October 19th at the Hotel Fort Garry. In the remarks that follow, the minister discussed the factors that have contributed to the rise of violence and economic hardship in the country.
The same day that, in the Organization of American States, was a resolution approved saying that, Venezuela's democracy was in peril or had lost was sort of derailed by President Maduro. When this took place, we started facing a very difficult time. We had a very difficult moments of violence in the streets. There was an unfortunate loss of lives. A lot of criticism, the current narrative in Western media says that this was when Venezuelan authorities attacked or were violent against protesters. And I have to say, in some cases, of course, you had some officials that might have exceeded. Taken actions that were not proper actions. But when you compare even to Venezuela's own history, if you go back to 1989 when the Caracazo, which was the first popular outburst against neoliberal policies in the country, the official count is that we lost about 290-some lives. But when you see the reality, there were mass graves, finding over 3,000 people had died during the repression that took place for that year. So when you compare it to Venezuela's own history, what I think is very outstanding of 2017 is that for the first time, or even 2014 as well, for the first time, people that exceeded their authorities and committed some sort of abuse were actually held accountable. These people were actually put into jail or processed, and that's something that was remarkable and that nobody wants to recognize. And also that, you know, about a third of the people, the victims of the kind of victims that that we lost during those days were actually members of, you know, police or security forces that were trying to stop these protests. So the idea that has been laid out that, you know, this was these deaths were part of Venezuelan repression or official repression was not actually accurate. The way we solved the issue of violence was something very impressive, I think, for modern democracy. See, when you think of how does democracy deal with violence, even liberal democracies would sort, you know, would turn to repression of some sort and you know, police forces to try to stop it. But I think the particularity that's outstanding in Venezuela is that the way a participatory democracy deals with violence in the streets is through more participation. And that was what President Maduro did. He made a call for a constituent assembly, as is allowed in our, in our 1999 constitution, because it was set out to, as a document, to renew itself every so often to adapt to the country's necessities. So it was a call for a constituent assembly that was accepted by a majority of Venezuelans. There was an opposition that tried to block the elections and tried to impede people from coming out and vote, but it was very important that a lot of people, despite those obstacles, came out and voted. And as soon as the vote took place, the day after, the country was completely pacified until now. Whatever reports you hear afterwards, you know, that since July of last year, that, you know, there's been violence and this, you know, there's the violence completely stopped after the Constituent Assembly was selected. And a new air, you know, I think, came through the country, that, you know, a new hope of progress through discussing the issues that we needed to discuss, through establishing a way of, you know, dealing with our economic problems through the Constituent Assembly and not through violence. What happened then, however, and this is very important for you, for me, and I'll close with this, what happened afterwards was that the international community, or at least the international interest, I should say, in Venezuela, decided that, you know, that was not acceptable. They felt that, you know, the only solution acceptable was for Chavismo to be out of the government, for President Maduro to be out of the government, and they needed to have a way of pushing that forward. And the United States, spearheading that movement, started implementing sanctions against Venezuela, or increasing sanctions that had already been in place. Some of these sanctions don't allow us to, you know, renegotiate our debt, and, you know, put more economic constraints on an already fragile economy. It doesn't allow us to repatriate dividends from CETO, which is our subsidiary of PDVSA, or our national oil company in the United States. It doesn't allow, it sort of condemns high-ranking officials in the Venezuelan government by name, putting them in some list that, you know, banks, companies, nobody wants to have a signature from any of these officials, because, you know, they're signaled out as people that are involved with crimes or this sort of thing, and companies might be even afraid of signing treaties with a country because their leaders are somehow under these coercive measures or sanctions. And in other important aspects other important actions that the U.S. government and some of their allies, including Canada, took against Venezuela, was to issue warnings to their banking system. This is not something that is usually described as one of the sanctions, but this is very important. They've issued warnings against, you know, to their banking system, saying, you know, whatever, you know, Venezuelan public money you've run into could be the subject of corruption, could be the subject of money laundering or drug money and so forth. And that has created a stoppage of the flow of Venezuelan currency to be able to pay for the importation of medicine, to be able to pay for, you know, importing food. You know, at the beginning of this year, of 2018, I could tell you that, you know, we needed malaria medicine, and we needed to purchase it, and we were not able to do so because companies, because some companies felt that, you know, they were not going to be, or they were going to receive some sanctions against them if they sold some of the components. At the beginning of the year, we had half, you know, of the chemical components that we needed to fight malaria, and the other half we couldn't purchase because of this reason. Or we had money stuck in banks because they weren't being able to transfer. Or to even something as that might not seem you might not believe, because you know in diplomatic relations there's always the guarantee that our diplomats and they can carry out their functions. Even in time of war, they could carry out their functions normally. But our diplomatic missions have faced the problems such as not being able to pay or at least to receive our money in order to pay our salaries, to pay our bills, electric bills, the water bills, etc. Because the banks will simply stop the a money transfer for more than a month, or 2 months, or even return the money transfers, because it comes from Venezuela, from the Venezuelan state, and it might be corrupt money, or it might be money that then is tied to some sort of crime. This is outrageous, because what this is doing is basically, it's not saying that Venezuela is it's allowing the narrative to be that Venezuela is in the midst of a humanitarian crisis, because it can't pay for food, or you can't pay for medicine. And that's not to say that there are not problems. I mean, these problems are there. But if we did not have these sanctions being applied financially to Venezuela, there would definitely be a different result. With the idea, with the notion that there's a humanitarian crisis, that there's a migratory crisis, which is also being promoted more recently, it's a platform to allow for intervention. It's a platform to allow for other countries to either come in militarily or, in any other ways, to pressure Venezuela. And, this is not a conspiracy theory. President Trump himself has said that he doesn't rule out the military option for Venezuela. And, we have to say that it is very worrisome that we have a neighbor in Colombia, which is strongly armed, and whose president, has also talked about very freely about not recognizing the government of Venezuela, and we could be facing a potential situation where not a direct intervention by the United States, but perhaps by some of our neighbors. And that is going to be justified by, tending to a crisis, a supposed existence of a humanitarian crisis that has been not only fabricated or augmented by the media narrative, but actually these sanctions that have been implemented against Venezuela.
That was Venezuelan Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs Carlos Ron Martinez speaking by Skype to a Winnipeg audience on October 19th, 2018. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.